good people, it is my pleasure to present to you the one and only number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person. In some place, at some time, all of you held positions of a secret nature and had knowledge that was invaluable to an enemy. Like me, you are here to have that knowledge protected or extracted.
That's the stuff to give them.
Unlike me, many of you have accepted the situation of your imprisonment and will die here like rotten cabbages.
Keep going, beloved.
The rest of you have gone over to the side of our keepers. Which is which? How many of each? Who's standing beside you now? I intend to discover who are the prisoners and who are the warders. I shall be running for office in this election.
Good people, let us applaud a citizen of character. May the better man win, and a big hand for number 6.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 14th of June 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Cross Arts Centre in Bristol, ye olde Templar port in the Empire of Lies. We're on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on that glorious little Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which you can get from all good app stores. Please use Aurora, though, not Google Play. In fact, you can use Google Play to download Aurora and then just disable Google Play. Oh, it's such a delight. Please give it a go. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. These McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III and wage slavery lies. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months, it seems, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies craftily crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us slaves to their machines. Albert Pike's World War III slugfest relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and the witch queen Camilla wage war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS with the Libya regime change maniac sidekick Diddy David Cameron filling in a few sound bites wherever Rishi Sunak or King Charles demur. So, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Fourth Reich Matrix more like, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one today, the European Union swung to the right and also reform. UK, the old Brexit party, goes pro-Nazi. We have a good old look at that. This is very interesting because old Farage did everything he could to keep any these neo-Nazis out of the Brexit party, whether they were sneakily in there or not. If they spoke a word, they were out. No more with reform. As reform overtakes the Tory party in the polls, we've got a neo-Nazi party. Great. Musk takes £45 billion out of Tesla as the electric car sales slump by 20%. Now, so what's going on here? He's cutting and running. I don't know if the shareholders see it. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, I see, by the way, was complaining, saying, hang on, what's he doing here? He's taking all the money out. Does he really believe in this anymore? Maybe he's just going to put it into something new, that £45 billion or dollars. And in part two, the SPIEF. I actually think maybe the St. Petersburg International Economic Summit should be called the Spies, the alternative to the World Economic Forum, Martin. What do you think?
Well, these things get called what they get called, don't they?
But it's nice if it was the, if it was a summit, it would be called Spies.
Yes, I take your point.
Okay. My pointless point. Yes. But in a way, it's fun, isn't it, over there? Because what you're getting is what we should be getting here with the World Economic Forum. If it wasn't some sort of, like, control freak Central with Schwab and his mates. Anyway, Putin's joke at Britain's expense over at St. Petersburg, as the show was going out last week, it's not worth wasting a nuke. The Britain is self-destructing. It's not. Don't waste a nuke on Britain, he says. Nuclear war also on the cards at the Schiller Institute. Scott Ritter, Colonel Richard Black, Ray McGovern and Zelga Zepp-LaRouche, who's the founder of the Schiller Institute, all talking about worrying, basically a warning to the United States about this idea of a nuclear war. So saber rattling, or is Europe about to be incinerated? Is Britain ready for war? We hear from some of the generals, and also a new dark Jerusalem. Do the deep state want Israel to be in the center of a one world government? We revisit that one. Another interesting little video I came across this week. So Iranian and Russian news banned here in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom a few days later. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet, thank God. So, Martin, let's start with this rather worrying trend we've got going in the general election campaign, which is the swerve to the right. Now, we've had a few examples this week of Reform UK candidates being uncovered as doing such things as saying the Muslims are Nazis, and also saying that we were wrong to fight Hitler in World War II. So, but those candidates have been allowed to stand, so they haven't stood them down as any self-respecting party would, but they're going with it. They think this is all far too important an election to win to bother about whether one of their candidates is a Nazi or not.
Well, if you think about it, Meloni, who's the Prime Minister of Italy, is basically an outright fascist. I mean, her party was the party of Mussolini.
They had the similar thing in Spain. I think you can say yes.
The parties of the right in Spain and Portugal have also come on
a bit since then, surely.
Well,
They're not Nazi parties, are they?
Well, they have. I mean, in Spain, for example, the PP, which was the follow-on party to Franco's party, they were the moderate right, but Vox are the extreme right. And, you know, we're getting this all over Europe.
So what about
it's not surprising we're getting it here.
What about the extreme left?
Well, the extreme left exists in most countries as well. Keir Starmer. I mean, in our country, it would be classified as the Corbynistas.
I don't think they're extreme, because I'm one of them.
The
extreme left is surely Starmer. These people who think that they can become neoliberals.
He's hardly the extreme left,
well,
is he?
Well, he is. I mean, the thing
Why?
Is, he's saying he's left, but he's actually extreme.
He's extreme neoliberal. He's not really of the left. That's the truth about Starmer.
Well, so the Labour Party is not left-wing at all?
Well, it's not. It's to the left. It's not very left-wing compared to, say, even the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, PSOE. Yeah, they are more left-wing than Labour Party.
Another thing we'll be looking at this week is the UN, because there's a couple of organs of the UN this week have been really strong about Gaza, almost totally unreported in the Western press, and this is one of the things I do quite a lot on here. We had a election debate last Friday evening when we were going out last week, Martin, at the same time as this St. Petersburg summit was going on over in St. Petersburg with Putin speaking. But I find this really, really annoying. They have the top seven parties. So why do the broadcasters choose, this is the BBC on this occasion, why do they choose the top seven parties and not the top eight? Well, if they were to choose the top eight, they'd have to include George Galloway in a live debate.
Well, in other words, like everything else that goes down, it's a bit of a fix. And you know, people say those things, do they not? And they're not necessarily wrong.
Yeah, they certainly do. Anyway, look, we'll start trying to redress that balance a little bit here by giving a little bit of coverage to the Workers' Party. That's George Galloway's genuinely left-wing party, not a neoliberal he. And I see this week that the former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, is standing as one of his candidates. I mean, he's trying in a way to make it a Gaza election, but they're also talking very much about raising living standards here, redistributing wealth from the rich to the poor, and in a way, they're talking about reindustrializing. They're saying that we need to have, whole loads of industry in this country which give people a decent job for life and a good income.
Well, obviously these are perfectly legitimate aspirations, and I share them. But of course, saying you're going to reindustrialise and actually being able to do it is another matter.
Well, is
but
it?
For them and for Chris everybody else.
If Chris Williams, Chris Williamson was here, he would say, actually, like you would say, in a way, Martin, you see, you're being a bit disingenuous there. Both of you agree that you can actually just print money and do this stuff if you want to. They could, for example, quite easily renationalise steel companies, what used to be British Steel, Tata Steel. They could take these places over. They're the government. They can do what they want.
Especially if they're going bankrupt. They're easy to take over in those circumstances.
Well,
but can you make them pay? That's another matter. Once you've deindustrialised, you can't necessarily reindustrialise. I'm not saying we shouldn't try or that it's not a worthy goal. I'm just saying, if it was as simple as that, it would be simple.
Well, there's
a lot
of this talk around farming as well. But before we hear from the farmers in Wales who had a little protest the other week in Cardiff, which again, it was one protest about 3 or 4 months ago, which got a little bit of coverage, a tiny little snip on the news. Now, when the Welsh farmers protest, you have to have a campaigner go down to make a film about them, to watch it on the internet and go and find it, because the mainstream media is not going to tell you anything. So anyway, let's start off by trying to redress the balance of the BBC crookedly shutting Galloway out of, I mean, if you think about it, by shutting Galloway out of the live election debate last Friday, what they've done is they've precluded any kind of like surge for his party. I remember in 2002, I cannot remember the guy's name for the life of me, but he had dreadlocks. He was a Rasta member of the New Zealand Green Party. Pretty sure it was 2002, if there was an election in 2002 over there. Anyway, he came on one of their live debates on New Zealand TV, and he blew the socks off everyone. He was talking about legalising cannabis and the reasons why, which are a lot to do with the sort of thing you talk about, Martin, which is, that prohibition is actually good for organised crime. And also about the medical effects of it. But then he launched into a whole sort of fascinating, which he understood economics very well, economic tirade about international economics and about New Zealand's place in the world. Anyway, the Greens had a 5-7% surge a few days later in their general election, because there'd been one person amongst all those traditional politicians over in New Zealand who suddenly the voters watching on TV think, oh, there's an interesting, blimey, it looks like these guys are pretty good, they might change something. Well, they've absolutely made sure that's impossible to happen with Galloway, haven't they?
Well, they have, and also, of course, in New Zealand they've got a proportional system, so that surge translates into seats. Whereas if the Greens could have a surge here, or Workers' Party could have a surge here, but because of the electoral system, it won't necessarily translate into seats, even if you've got more votes.
But you see, the EU elections have got a PR system,
yep,
which we've just had, the MEP elections. We will get to Craig Murray in a minute, I promise you. But you're sparking off my little synapses here, thinking about what's going on with them, because we've just had Claire Daly as lost, even though the Greens have still got a lot of support in...
she's not a Green.
Oh, sorry, what party is she?
I can't remember what they're called. It's her and Mick Wallace's party. It's just their party.
But anyway, whoever they are, she is down the list. It can't be her party, otherwise she'd be at the top of the list. She has fallen off, so she doesn't get re-elected.
She didn't get as many votes as she needed to get elected.
It's not the number of votes for the person. You're voting for the party.
Yes.
So the party decides where you are on the list. And this is a way of getting someone like Claire Daly and pushing her out. So,
well, I think she was pushed out more by the media.
That's not the case, because people were not voting for her, they were voting for the party, as you should know in the PR system.
I haven't followed the detail of this, Tony, but I understand.
Anyway,
that
what I'm
she
saying
didn't
is
have
your
votes.
Wonderful PR is manipulable.
Well,
so as soon
if
as
everything's
you go,
manipulable,
if
Tony,
you go into PR, you can manipulate somebody out if you don't like them. I think Mick Wallace that's the guy who
did
get in, but she was one on the list below him. So it's up to the party over there to decide who's who and which order on the list, and they can use that. You know what, I'm pledging to do this now, is to get Jungle Bus Millie on, who's very familiar with electoral politics over in Holland, and let's have a good old thrashing out of this first past the post, because she loves first past the post.
Well, yes, but she doesn't have to live under it.
No, exactly. Well, she does. She does live here. She lives here. She grew up under the PR system, so it'd be really good at some point in the next few weeks to get you two having a proper, let's have a, like, sort of... grown-up debate about PR versus first past the post, especially after we've had our general election result. We'll be on to look at this whole thing of the Reform Party and Farage overtaking the Tories. That's how bad you are, Rishi Sunak. That's how rubbish you are. And also Farage saying that he wants to have a new coalition party. He wants to be the leader of a new Tory party in coalition with Reform. Anyway, on the other end of the spectrum, the people who they've been shutting out of this general election, the media, trying to make sure that they don't we don't have a democracy. Let's have a listen to Craig Murray launching his campaign earlier this week.
I am here because of the genocide which is happening in Gaza. And if it were not for Gaza, I would not be here. I am here fighting this election on the need to stop the genocide in Gaza. And the Workers' Party of Britain have a wonderful manifesto. They have policies on all the kinds of things the Labour Party has abandoned. They have parties on the nationalisation of their policies on the nationalisation of public utilities. They have policies on the tuition fees for university students. And I should say, I live in a country, Scotland, which has the tuition fees for university students. So it most certainly is not impossible, and the Keir Starmer pretend it is impossible. It's a complete and utter nonsense. They have policies on the National Health Service. Actually, I'm going, if no one objects,
I'm going to try to speak to you without the microphone because I think actually my natural voice is even more beautiful than my voice.
But every election, you get lots of candidates. My entire lifetime, you get candidates from the political parties who stand up and tell you that they're going to make the health service better, that they're going to make education better, that they're going to fix the potholes. And certainly, ever since I was a student, for every election that's happened since Thatcher came to power and since Blair adopted Thatcherism as the Labour Party's policy, every election's been followed, whatever the politician has said, by the health service getting worse, by education getting worse, and by the potholes getting worse. And frankly, whichever of the main parties anyone votes for, that is what's going to happen. So you don't need me to talk about that. I'm going to talk to you about Gaza and the genocide in Gaza. And it is a genocide. It's a genocide we have all witnessed. It's a genocide we are seeing in real time on our laptops, iPads, and mobile phones. It's a genocide which is emotionally devastating. It's physically devastating to the people of Gaza. Can you imagine what those people are going through? But to us, it's emotionally devastating. And I'll tell you bluntly, I reach the stage where sometimes I can't look at my own children because it makes me cry thinking of the children I have seen killed in Gaza. It is that emotionally devastating. And this genocide did not start on the 8th of October. This genocide started 76 years ago. And we are only going now through a hotter phase because the slow genocide of the Palestinian people has been in progress and has been the plan ever since the formation of the state of Israel. And we live in a country which is continuing to send arms to Israel, which is continuing to give military training to Israel, which is continuing to give intelligence support, aerial surveillance to Israel in real time, a country which is deeply complicit in that genocide. I want to see it stop. And I tell you this, I want to see absolutely the end of arms sales to Israel. I don't want a suspension. I want to see never again any arms sales to Israel. But let me say this to you as well. I don't just want to see an end to arms sales to Israel. I want to see an end to the terrorist state of Israel. An end to the There is no two-state solution. We The idea of a two-state solution is a nonsense. There's not enough left of Palestine, with the depredations on the West Bank, which is broken up into tiny pockets, which get smaller literally every single day. And in the last few weeks, 3,500 more Palestinian homes have been designated for removal and replacement by Israeli settlement. There is no possibility of a viable state consisting of the remnants of Palestine in the West Bank and what is left of devastated Gaza. What we need to see is a single unitary state of Palestine in which everybody is equal, be they Jewish, be they Palestinian, be they Christian, whoever they are, of any religion or race, living in a modern, genuinely democratic state with no apartheid. We want an end to apartheid and an end to colonialism.
So that's Craig Murray launching his campaign in Blackburn, Lancashire, which is just sort of just outside Manchester. Can you what do you make of his this pitch? Because he's talking briefly about the domestic policies, but it seems that the Galloway Party, the Workers' Party of Britain, is really focusing on foreign policy. And are they right to do that?
Well, I think there's once in a generation something comes along like this, which demands an exceptional response. We can't just stand by and watch millions of Palestinian children starve to death. And I want to know what any politician is going to do about that. And we know very well that the mealy-mouthed mainstream parties are complicit in what's going on. And therefore it's absolutely legitimate for people to stand up and say that's no good. Because, of course, you know, these things are very important. It's not just the moral aspects of the genocide that's going on. It's potentially World War III. And if you're talking about the cost of living crisis, what do you think is going to happen to the cost of living in this country if we carry on going to war with Yemen and go to war with Iran on the back of our existing war with Yemen? That will destroy the British economy. So if we're going to talk about, you know, solving the problems of the British economy, we've got to solve the problem of World War III first, haven't we?
We have. Nigel Farage this week has claimed the reform candidate who said Britain should not have fought Hitler was only airing ordinary down the pub opinions as he squirms over World War II row, saying it's too late to take dodgy would-be MPs off the ballot paper. He was quizzed over remarks made by some of the party's state of election hopefuls, including Ian Gribbin, who suggested the UK should not have fought Nazi Germany in the Second World War. In a difficult LBC phone-in, he suggested his predecessor as leader, Richard Tice, was to blame for the failure to vet candidates, saying he had only been in the post for 9 days. But Martin, he, as the new leader, could easily tell this guy on your bike, couldn't he?
Well, it's interesting because it's not quite clear how the Reform Party is run. Don't forget that the Brexit Party was a private organisation.
But he answered the question, yes or no. He could, couldn't he?
In theory, if it's still the Reform Party is still like the Brexit Party, that was a private Farage project. So he could just turn around and say, "I'm sacking everybody."
This is after it was infiltrated by Tommy Robinson.
Well, indeed. But the point is, UKIP, as a political UKIP. Party, it's not necessarily a democratic party.
Oh, it doesn't have to be. Is the Labour Party?
No, the Labour Party isn't necessarily.
Can we just talk about the topic, which is whether someone like this should be allowed to stand as a Reform Party candidate? I mean, I think, it's, in a way, for me, this is the big story of the week, the way that Reform is showing its true colours now as actually a racist neo-Nazi party.
Well, obviously, some people like myself were pretty much convinced of that years ago. The thing is that Farage deciding that he is going to take over and stand, he's also said that he's not going to back down this time, because I think what he's looking to do is displace the Conservative Party as the party of the, you know, he was saying on that debate, we're going to be the main opposition to a Labour government, basically, is what he was saying.
Yeah, well, he may well be, but that's not the point. Ian Gribbin, who's standing for Nigel Farage's party in Bexhill and Battle, said that Britain would be better off today if it had taken up the German fascist dictator's offer of neutrality. Now, is there any benefit, or is there any credence to that idea? But Britain being neutral in World War II?
Well, it's been around ever since that era, because of course quite a lot of people in the establishment at the time were of that opinion. But of course, subsequently, victory and all the rest of it, which was largely the responsibility of the Soviets, led to the discrediting of the very idea that we should have surrendered or made peace in 1940. So it's not surprising that these views on the right have always been there. Let's revisit this properly,
because there was a whole programme of appeasement, wasn't it, with Chamberlain again and again, saying, we need to be neutral with Hitler. Let's not just try and push him around.
Don't forget.
At some point we might have to go to war, but for now, let's just...
Well, in actual fact, it's worse than that. Because of the threat of communism in places like Germany, the establishment in Germany and the establishment in the West was pretty keen to have something to block the communists from taking. But don't forget, there was nearly a communist revolution in Germany in 1918. And if that had happened, then that would have been a different fork in the road again, wouldn't it? So, all of these things come back in the end, because all of the fundamental problems that created these conflicts in the first place are still there.
Can I just mention that in 1939, two very important figures in the British establishment who were vehemently pro-Hitler. One is Montagu Norman, who was the governor of the Bank of England, who was doing everything, bending over backwards to make sure Hitler got plenty of money, as he was part of the sort of international financial cartel based in Switzerland. And the other one, of course, was King Edward VIII, who, after Dunkirk, he actually was down in Lisbon encouraging Hitler to bomb London. So, you know, there was a very strong, in high parts of the establishment, a lot of people were rooting for Hitler. Why?
Because, as I say, they saw the main threat to their wealth, power and empire being the communists, and therefore that Hitler was the sort of chap who could stop the communists from coming to power in Germany, just as they supported Franco in Spain to prevent a left-wing government in Spain from nationalising stuff and creating a bad example, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
Well, anyway, any of our really attentive listeners will have noticed a couple of weeks ago, right at the very end of the show, we had a clip from The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin's late 30s film about Hitler, which is well worth another watch if you get a chance. But at the end of the day, I think it's pretty clear Farage could sack these people for their comments, but he's decided that he wants to have his people on the ballot and they can always pretty much say what they want.
Well, that's right, but of course the opposition to Farage are going to pick all these people up and bang him over the head with them, which is their job, which is what they've done. Good for them.
This kind of started at the beginning of the week, last weekend, with this whole comment by Farage about the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak doesn't care about our history and our culture. He's othering him. What do you make of that comment?
Well, I think these kind of smirk-like dog whistles that Farage goes in for, he can play that kind of game if he likes, but we're going to have freedom of speech as well, and we're going to say, you're a racist, Nigel.
Do you know
and
who's...
And say, no, I'm not. No, say, yes,
well,
yes,
maybe,
you are.
Maybe
yes,
he
you
is,
are,
maybe
Nigel.
He
you are, you are, you are.
But do you know who's responsible for this? Is those that have encouraged mass immigration. People like you, Martin.
I haven't encouraged mass immigration, Tony. It's just happened. As a result of all sorts of things we could go into.
Magic wand. Who's waving that wand then?
Well, I tell you, the people that are coming in at the moment to work in the health service and the care sector are the people we have to recruit. They're coming in with visas to do that work.
They're not waving any magic wands. They're being recruited.
No, they're being recruited by the health service managers.
No, abroad to come in here.
Yes, because the British don't want to work for that kind of money.
Yeah.
Well, no, they don't, Tony.
It's called trade unionism.
No.
Anyway, let's have a listen to
if there's only trade unionism, Tony, we've got to massively increase the amount of money we pay those people. Farage is in favour of lowering taxes.
Trade unions.
If you're going to pay more money to people in care homes, you've got to raise taxes on people like Farage.
Trade unions try and keep wages up. Anyway, let's have a listen to Farage, who was saying last weekend that the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak doesn't care about our history and our culture. Well, he doesn't care about this country, and he could be right, couldn't he? Because maybe Sunak is going to be off to California as soon as he loses this election.
Firstly, your reaction to the Prime Minister missing the end of the D-Day anniversary.
It's appalling, and it shows the man doesn't understand. You know, he's not basically patriotic. He doesn't care about our history, frankly, our culture. You know, D-Day was an amazing operation between the Americans, Canadians and us. It was the beginning of the liberation of Europe. It was done at huge sacrifice. There are still people alive that were there, and they were back on those beaches. It's the last time they'll ever be there. But that didn't matter to the Prime Minister. No, getting back to do an interview seemed to take a higher priority. And it shows just how disconnected this Prime Minister is. And that's a big problem, because the one thing you've always associated the Conservatives with is being a patriotic party. Well, it's now got an unpatriotic leader.
So he's really playing the, he's saying us and them. He's talking about Sunak as another culture. He's a Hindu, his family are Indian. Why should he care about England?
Well, don't forget that the Indian army, which had many Hindus in it, Sikhs and Muslims,
but it wasn't a major factor
in Britain's war effort in both world wars.
What about his point about the difference in culture?
Well, the difference in culture. What about the guy who Farage is saying down the pub, he says, well, maybe we should have sided with Hitler in World War II. Does he understand our culture? Is he going to be struck off the reform list? No, he's not. It's freedom of speech. Of course, it's a legitimate point of view that we shouldn't have fought Hitler. And you can be in the Reform Party and have that point of view, but you can't point fingers at other people for being patriotic or unpatriotic.
So what about this discussion that was also had this week about Muslims being Nazis?
Well, it's just Islamophobia of the worst kind, is it not? Nigel Farage is probably of French origin, probably Huguenot. And we let his people in back in the day because they were being persecuted for their religious beliefs.
Anyway, let's have a listen to a clip.
Perhaps he should just go home back to France.
Let's have a listen to a clip about this now from LBC.
You've got about 1 in 10 people who have Nazi sympathies.
That is utter cobblers, and you know it. I've explained this to you. People chuck stuff around on Facebook and they like comments. If you didn't know who Gary Rakes is, how could our guys know?
Well, why has the vetting failed? Let me take you to a candidate called Steve Chilcott.
Never heard of him.
Standing in London.
Never heard of him.
Islam and Nazis are the same thing. Sean Matthews standing in the seat in Lincolnshire talking about children having their penises chopped off. If we come back to Hitler references, I could go through so many of your candidates.
Well, I'm sorry. Hang on a second. I think
Jake Fraser.
I think people being alarmed about sex conversion therapy for children. I mean, you think you'll find that's quite a big majority view.
Let's come back to that.
Most of your listeners are worried about it. I bet you.
Jake Fraser in Cheshire, the British public is like, there's a health holocaust, is what COVID was. John Edwards, who's standing in one of the Southampton seats, vaccine producers are like Nazi armament companies. I could go on and on and on.
Well,
your image is carefully honed.
I've never honed an image in my life. I'm who I am. I've never pretended to be anything different to what I am.
They're
ordinary people. That's how people out there speak. That's how they feel.
Ordinary people, Mr. Farage, say Islam and Nazis are the same thing.
Well, I can tell you something.
They both want to kill Jews.
Do you know why Churchill, in 1933, was almost the only person to see Hitler as a threat? Because he'd seen it with fanatical Islam when he fought against it in the 1890s. Now, we've moved on, we're 80 years on, but people are allowed to have opinions. People are allowed to express views.
You're not supporting the idea that Islam are Nazis. Just to clarify there, Mr. Farage.
No, I'm scared of all fanaticisms.
You're equally scared of Islam as you would
be... No. You're making a very big mistake. I'm asking you. I'm not talking about Islam.
Okay.
At all. In fact...
But your candidate is Islam and Nazis are the same thing.
A very, very prominent...
They both want to kill Jews. They both hate homosexuals.
A very prominent businessman who happens to be a follower of Islam... has joined our party this week. I'll be unveiling him next week. The vast majority of moderate Muslims in this country agree with similar principles to you and me. What is worrying is Islamism, extremism. And I tell you what, most Islamic people would agree with that statement.
Okay, lastly on this, you have one candidate, Ian Gibbins, who seems to have totally the contrary view as you to concerns Winston Churchill. It would have been far better if Britain had taken Hitler up on his offer of neutrality.
Well, that's what most of the cabinet thought in 1939-40.
Yes, can we talk about 2024?
Well, yeah, I think the Daily Mail thought that quite strongly at the time.
Okay, can we talk about 2024?
It's a blooming stupid thing to say, and no question.
Is he going to be disciplined?
What can you do? His name's on the ballot paper. I can't remove it.
Have you gone raving mad?
I've got more time to spend than to talk to someone like that.
So there you go. That was quite good, actually. I thought LBC getting all those little quotes in together, Martin, and showing that there isn't really any... He says, people can say whatever they want. I mean, that's not actually... the basis for a an organised ruling party that's well, they're obviously not going to be a ruling party, but, you know, a serious political party. It sounds to me as if they just want to try and grab the votes and they don't care who's standing.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, to say that I've got no responsibility for any of these people, even though they're in my party and they're standing as MPs for my party, is a bit of a cop-out, isn't it? Nobody else would be allowed to get away with that. Keir Starmer wouldn't get away with it. Rishi Sunak wouldn't get away with it. But here, you know, Farage is treated as an overgrown schoolboy and he's given all of this kind of indulgence. But of course, I'm totally in favour with what he's saying, but everybody should have freedom of speech. And if I say, Nigel Farage, you're a crypto fascist, that's my honest judgment.
Anyway, let's try.
And you're opening the door to a civil war in this country.
As you might have realised, I'm quite much more interested in the fringe parties in this general election than I am in the Uniparty. Mm. And so let's come back to a sort of air of sanity with George Galloway. And here he is, a campaign launch for Stratford and Urmston, wherever that is, this week.
We didn't even possess Palestine as a colonial possession at the moment that we gave it away to somebody else. We gave it away to a European settler who wanted a piece of the colonial action, was prepared to take Uganda, prepared to take the Seychelles, prepared to take Patagonia in Argentina, was prepared to take anywhere that they could establish their white European colonial settlement. And it is the eternal misery of the Arabs in Palestine that they were eventually settled upon as the site of what they call Israel. None of what I'm saying could be said by any Labour politician. It's not just that they wouldn't say it, they couldn't say it. They'd be expelled for saying it. They'd be smeared and slandered as an anti-Semite for saying it. But we in the Workers' Party alone say that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. And we will not rest until... The media like to throw up their hands in horror at that. But why? What's wrong with being free? What, do you want them to be unfree? What's wrong with between the river and the sea? That's what Palestine was. And inshallah, one day will be again. So we are bold. I like to think we are brave, but above all, we are clear. We stand with the oppressed against the oppressor. We stand for what is right. And that's why I'm appealing to you to vote with your conscience on the 4th of July. Some people say you should vote for the lesser of two evils. But first of all, if you do, evil always wins. I mean, it's a matter of simple logic. If you choose the lesser of two evils, somebody that's evil will always win. Why not choose somebody that isn't evil? Wouldn't that be a better idea? But in any case, it is impossible to discern in today's Britain which of these two men is the lesser of two evils. I'll be candid with you, and I know both of them. I've just spent 54 days sitting in this parliament, up close and personal. For me, Starmer is more evil than Sunak. More likely to do anything that Netanyahu asks. More likely to do anything that Biden or Trump asks, more likely to take us into war after war, more likely to betray the working people of this country. If I may, in this sports club, quote my brother Malcolm X. Malcolm explained it thus: there are wolves and there are foxes. The wolf is obvious. He looks at you. Obviously, he intends to eat you. But the fox appears to be smiling, while its intention is exactly the same. Well, give me a wolf before the fox anytime. I'd rather have an honest enemy than a lying, deceiving enemy that pretends to be any kind of friend of the people. And I'm asking you to vote with your consciences on the 4th of July.
The leader of the Workers' Party of Britain, George Galloway, speaking earlier this week, Martin. I mean, his accusation against Starmer being a warmonger, we've been talking about this week after week, as we've got with him, advising him behind the scenes, R. Peter Mandelson. There is also, of course, Alistair Campbell and the notorious Tony Blair, the war criminal Tony Blair. These guys, it does start to look like a war operation that may be coming in, and it does look as if Labour are going to win with quite a sizeable majority. That's going to be right in place, isn't it? As after the 4th of July.
Yes, it may well be so, and we may well be in a major war before then or soon thereafter. And I think the fact that you've got the Labour Party itself will split in that case. So, I mean, that's why they've got rid of Fazia Shaheen in Chingford, because she was going to win, and she would have been one of those people that would have opposed what may happen. So we elect Starmer, and Starmer turns around and says, we're all off to what?
Opposed to genocide?
Well, she's been removed because she was opposed to genocide. She's a Muslim academic at the LSE, and she's been the candidate for Chingford, which is where she was born, since 2019. And she was only lost by 1,000 votes to Ian Duncan Smith. So there's every opportunity, every chance that she's going to take it this time. But she's been taken off the ballot, unlike the man who thinks we shouldn't have fought Hitler by Farage.
Well,
she's
no,
been taken
no,
off
no,
the
no,
ballot
no,
by
let's
Starmer.
Let's just be fair and absolutely accurate, Martin. This is before the final close of nominations last Friday, isn't it? She's been taken off. Whereas he's saying these comments have come to light after we're stuck with this guy as a candidate. So try and be fair.
All right. Well, I didn't. Let's try and be fair. But the point is, she's going to stand now as an independent, and I hope she can win. But of course, she may not win, which means that we're going to have Ian Duncan Smith back in the next parliament as a result of Starmer.
We're going to have a whole load of these disenfranchised, disenchanted Labour candidates, including obviously Jeremy Corbyn too in Islington. So, what do you think? What do you make? I mean, this is really they're shooting themselves in the foot, aren't they? Maybe Starmer just thinks, "Oh, we're going to get such a whacking majority, we don't need people like Corbyn or your friend in Chingford."
Well, there's two things going through Starmer's mind. One is, I've got to keep the establishment, the deep state, on side. That's really important, because Corbyn, obviously freaked them out. I've got to be not Corbyn, you know. The other thing is, because of the first-past-the-post system, the former Tory voters, the swing voters in places like Billericay, determine British elections. It's absurd. These people have absolutely disproportionate power. But the people who read the Daily Express and the Daily Mail, who sometimes vote Labour, you know, read The Sun, but sometimes vote Labour, they decide the elections. Now, of course, that doesn't happen in other European countries. They have their vote, but they don't decide it all. It's absurd. That's why we get into such a mess.
Well, during the week, we had a debate. Well, it wasn't a debate, was it? It was a head-to-head with the two main party leaders. And the ironic thing is that they're so rubbish, both of these two, that the day after we get the first YouGov poll saying that actually the Conservative Party is below Reform. So that may well have influenced it, because Sunak gave such an appalling, and Starmer gave such an appalling performance in these one-to-one leader debates. But the interesting thing about them was, first of all, that this was the debate which Rishi Sunak came back from the D-Day commemorations last week. And why? So why does it take, like, best part of a week for, I think it was ITV in this case, or Channel 4, I'm not sure who, to actually air these things?
It's
so
Sky.
Things can change. Skype. Things Sky. Can change so much in a general election campaign within a week. I don't like this, the way that they, you know, it's a bit like when they, everyone votes and then the ballot boxes disappear somewhere under lock and key where no one can get to them apart from maybe someone who's, you know, got that key to the lock. And then they pop out a couple of days later, and then they're counted. So I don't like this at all, this whole idea. All these debates should be live. They shouldn't be pre-recorded.
The interview that he did to Sky was not part of that debate. You're mixing these things up. The head-to-head last week was not what he came back for.
What was it then?
No, he came back for an interview with Sky about... I can't remember what it was about.
I think it was. I mean, we can have a look into this later.
These are matters of fact.
Yes, well, I think you're right, and I think I'm right, and I think you're wrong, that he did come back.
No, he didn't come back, because Starmer was stayed in Normandy, and he was featured shaking hands with Zelensky. God help us.
That's more important.
Yeah, so in other words, they didn't come back to do this debate. It was another, because that was an ITV one.
It wasn't a debate. It was just an interview.
It was just an interview about
the two main party leaders. That's all it was. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make was, during that, Keir Starmer got called a robot.
Well, that's a fair comment, isn't it?
You're a robot. And he couldn't, and it was this awful moment, he couldn't answer.
The last year, I feel like you've formed into more of a politician than the person that I would have voted for to run the country. You seem more like a political robot. How are you going to convince others like me to vote for you?
Well, the most...
What do you think? Is he a robot?
What he is what he is. He's, in his own terms, he's being quite successful here. Because what he's trying to do is position the Labour Party...
His only success is by not being as bad as Sunak.
Yes, and that's enough to win first pass of the post elections, I'm afraid. All you have to do. It's like Arsenal used to... And, of course, he's an Arsenal fan because he's from North London. Arsenal used to play for a draw all the time. Well, as long as you get the point and you get to the top of the table, that's all you do.
George Galloway. But what do you make about reform to sort of start winding up this general election coverage, Martin? The idea that potentially after the election, Nigel Farage could lead either a new party or a coalition with the Tories.
I think what they're going to find is, because it's first past the post, even if they pip the Tories, all that will happen is that they take the Tory candidate. This may save Fazia Shaheen in Chingford. Because if Reform are going to stand against Ian Duncan Smith, that takes away his thousand vote majority. Yeah, where am I going with all that?
Thousand seat majority.
Yes, thousand seat majority, that'd be good. If you've got multiple parties standing on both the left and the right in a first past the post election, it becomes very interesting from a bookmaker's point of view. It really does. William Hill are going to be having a good.
So where's your money?
Well, I'm with Craig, the advisor to Sunak, that said there's going to be a July election. He put £100 on that.
Well, I know this. Yeah. What it shows you is just the culture of the sort of people Sunak has been recruiting, but not just as his advisors, but also into the cabinet. Seeing Laura Trott get completely dismantled on the PM programme a couple of months ago by Evan Davis, because she thinks the national debt is going to go down when actually it's going up. She thinks it's going down. He says, no, it's going up. And in fact, everyone says it's going up. So why are you saying it's going down? You've got a bunch of, like, kind of used car salesmen, really. This isn't a cabinet at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, and there's no real gravitas there of any kind, is there? And that's across the spectrum. They are callow, shallow people, virtually all of them.
Yeah. So, what's your thoughts about the result at this stage, especially with this news this week about?
Well, obviously, the best result from my point of view would be a Starmer Prime Minister, but without an overall majority, because the left manages to coordinate tactical voting to make sure that the Labour Party, especially the pro-war Labour Party, has its wings clipped. Well, that's a bit like Modi in India. Yeah, what's happened in India is Modi was expected to win an overall supermajority. He's going to rule forever. And, of course, the opposition parties, first past the post in India, the opposition parties all got together and put up one candidate against him in every constituency. And he actually reduced the number of seats that he had. He didn't increase them. And he's now got to form a coalition, which is the first time that's ever happened to him. So that can happen to Starmer as well. Because, you know, people in Scotland, for example, may not vote Labour because of the position on Gaza. That's the SNP have definitely staked that position out. We want a ceasefire. Does Labour want a ceasefire? And it's not just Muslims in Scotland who want to cease fire. They've got a radical tradition.
Well, George Galloway's always pointing that out. Well, what about this idea of the war party, the war cabinet, with Keir Starmer at its helm, soon to take over Britain? So let's have a listen now to, I think it was last week, it was an interesting defence press conference that Starmer gave, and he was, well, some bright spark journalist asked him about, well, okay, so you're going to give MPs a vote on whether to have military action or not? I mean, is there any point in doing it? They don't seem to have had a vote on Yemen, Martin, do they?
They don't, although in actual fact, that's what they promised that they would do. Is that if there was ever any going to be in military action, the Chilcot report and all the rest of it. Well, yes, so we've learned the lesson. There'll have to be a parliamentary vote, but no.
Parliament.
We just did it.
Just becomes a kind of
rubber stamp.
Well, a puppet show, a kind of sideshow. Anyway, let's listen to what House Starmer. Let's see if he actually bit that bullet. My guess is he didn't.
In 2020, you vowed to introduce a new law to giving MPs a vote before any military action. Do you still stand by that pledge? I think you called it the Prevention of Military Intervention Act.
Yes, I think it's very important that if there's to be military action, that there is the support of Parliament for it. Now, it has to be sustained military action, of course. We've had the Houthi attacks and the response to that as a one-off response where we haven't had votes. But where it's sustained, I do think, and this is actually something David Cameron effectively introduced, its practice and convention, if you like, because he could see, and I can see, the importance of ensuring that the whole House is behind any action that is deployed. And I think for our armed forces, it is important as well, if it's sustained action, for them to know that Parliament is fully behind the action that they are being asked to take when they put their lives on the line. Thank you very much, Ashley. Max from The Times.
Max Kennett from The Times. Last year, you said you would repeal the Northern Ireland Legacy Bill, which gives an amnesty for crimes committed during the Troubles. That bill was supported by many of the veterans groups you stand alongside. Are you still committed to repealing it? And if so, are you worried about dragging elderly veterans into the courtrooms again?
Well, I am committed to repealing it. And I'll tell you for why. I worked in Northern Ireland for 5 years, working as part of the Good Friday Agreement, to establish the police service of Northern Ireland and to ensure that that police service had the confidence of all communities. And that was a very successful piece of work, never complete in Northern Ireland, but a hugely important part of our history, which is very important to me in terms of my journey. In relation to that legislation, for a government in Westminster to pass legislation which has the support of no political party in Northern Ireland and no community in Northern Ireland is, in my view, a mistake, particularly based on my experience in Northern Ireland. And I would actually dispute that across the armed services that they're all against the they're all against repealing or the legislation because it provides an amnesty for all sides, including the terrorists. And I know that many people feel extremely uncomfortable about that. I don't doubt the issue has to be resolved, but resolving it without the consent and the support of the communities and political parties in Northern Ireland, in my experience having worked in Northern Ireland for 5 years, is not the right way to resolve this admittedly difficult issue. Thank you so much, Max. Jim from the FT.
Well, I mean, I hate to say this, but I actually agree with the second part of what he said there. He is quite right. It's absurd for the British government in Westminster to force on the people of Northern Ireland, whatever side they're on, something they don't want, which is an amnesty for everybody involved in anything, just so that some British Army guys like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, if I can mention him, won't ever be prosecuted. I don't think the Good Friday Agreement could have included something like that in it, but it wasn't acceptable to anybody. It wasn't acceptable to Sinn Féin because they wanted to see people like Brigadier Gordon Kerr in the dock, and it wasn't acceptable to the Unionists because they want to see people from the IRA side who've managed to evade prosecution in the dock. So, therefore it was agreed that these cases wouldn't be closed and that the Police Service of Northern Ireland would continue to investigate them as open cases. Now, obviously, as time goes by, it becomes increasingly difficult to prosecute them. Are we ever going to prosecute Brigadier Brigadier Gordon Kerr, or Colonel Gordon Kerr, as he was when he used to run the Pulse Research Unit. Most people have never heard who he was. And, of course, when they got the people, of course, people in the Republican side know who he is. But, of course, the people, what they're talking about there is elderly chaps who were in parachute regiment on Bloody Sunday. But who should be prosecuted for Bloody Sunday is General Robert Ford, who gave the orders to shoot. He's the one who should be in the dock.
Well, not do you know who should be prosecuted for Bloody Sunday is Lord Peter Carrington.
Well, maybe so.
The Secretary General of NATO, who was Defence Secretary on the day of Bloody Sunday.
Yes.
Who most obviously gave the nod to this
stuff. Yes, indeed. This is why the British establishment wants to close the book on all of this. Because in actual fact, if we looked into it seriously, we would see that the British state was responsible for a lot of the violence in Northern Ireland, directly and indirectly. But the Chief Intelligence Officer of the UDA... was on Brigadier Gordon Kerr's books. That's Brian Nelson. And the Chief Intelligence Officer, Counterintelligence Officer of the IRA, Frank Scapitacci, was on the British Army's payroll. So very senior terrorists on both sides of the campaign were both working for the British Army. You can imagine the British Army doesn't really want that to come out, and therefore they want it all closed down. Just as they want to close down investigations to what the SAS got up to in Afghanistan. But ultimately, of course, the law is supposedly independent of political considerations, which is why you've got to pass a law in the Westminster Parliament to stop the police doing their job. Now, the police's job is to carry on looking into all of this in a fearless fashion without fear or favour. And that's what the communities on both sides in Northern Ireland want.
Have we got any hope of that? And what's the political future in Northern Ireland? We're going to see a united Ireland soon, surely.
It'll only come about when people are willing to accept it on both
there'll
sides.
There'll be a vote, surely.
There will be ultimately a vote.
On both sides? Yeah, on both sides of the border?
You can't look, the Republican movement had accepted that the Loyalists are not going to be forced into united Ireland if they don't want to go. And as things stand at the moment, they don't. So we're not going to have a border poll until it becomes clear that majority want to have a united Ireland. It's not clear, that's not clear. It will happen because of the demography. You know, there are large, one of the things that could have happened at one stage in this conflict is the repartition of Ireland. That was originally what the plan was, which is what Collins had signed with Lloyd George and Churchill, was that the border would be based upon which communities lived where. But it was the British who insisted on having the 6 counties of Northern Ireland carved out of Ireland, even though 9 counties of Ulster were the original province of Ulster. And, of course, in this hunger strike, which we were talking about...
Let's just make it clear here, because these were the more industrialised counties, weren't they? Not the rural ones.
At the time.
And actually, the idea was that the nationalists or the Republican population, they wanted to keep them as rural farmers, whereas the new unionist pro-UK or pro-British... well, we can call them Protestants, but actually the fact was that the unionists...
Just call them loyalists or unionists.
They had the industrial areas, and they were making the industrial profits. So there was a massive cultural difference between the two sides of the divide. Well, and that's why they did those counties and not, as you were saying, Ulster...
The original proposal was that, just as had happened in Poland, in Silesia, at the same time, in the 1920s, you try and draw a border which in fact separates the two communities. And of course they did it in Silesia, and the Germans had to move to one side and
most
of
the time,
to another.
The British Empire seemed to draw borders that don't do that. That's certainly what happened in Ukraine, and not just the British Empire, obviously, but the powers that be. In Kashmir, they draw borders which don't have any real... They try and make sure that there's a tension on that border where you've got half of one community one side and half the other.
Yes, and that's if the original proposal, Spike Milligan's book, Pocoon, is all about the commission that was sent to Ireland to draw the border, and they were basically taking evidence about which communities lived where. Now, if they'd done that, of course, you'd have had to have a border through Belfast, so that West Belfast would have been in the Republic of Ireland, and the rest of it would have been in Britain. Now, of course, it doesn't make sense at the end of the day to necessarily draw borders like that. But, of course, he could have had the 9 counties of Ulster, which was the original, you know, like the Ukraine is supposedly a unitary state. The Ulster was a unitary county in Ireland, historically, going back hundreds of years. But that had a majority of nationalists. So during the hunger strike, Bobby Sands was elected from Northern Ireland, but 2 other hunger strikers were elected to the Dáil under proportional system in Cavan and Monaghan, because Cavan and Monaghan and Donegal used to be part of Ulster, and they were carved out of Ulster so that they could have their basically sectarian state. Mm. But it was a sectarian state with a one-third population who didn't accept the existence of the state, which is a recipe for future war.
Well, yeah,
as
well,
we now
and
know.
This is what they do, isn't it? And you know, interesting that maybe the way the Good Friday Agreement went in Northern Ireland could be used as a template for peace in Gaza. Who knows? But Martin, we're talking here about the secret state, these big shenanigans that go on. Really, it's the permanent government. It doesn't matter who you're electing, really. And it just so happened to fall on Blair's watch that the IRA decided they were going to. Actually, it was just before Blair, wasn't it, that they were going to do massive explosions in the City of London in order to force the Good Friday Agreement and negotiation. This tactic, I notice, was also used by Palestine Action last weekend, where we saw 19 or 20 Barclays banks smashed to pieces. I mean, literally the whole frontage smashed with sledgehammers right across the country, and red paint splashed all over these Barclays banks. And this is as a result of a interesting report put together by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I think this these three, War on Want and the Campaign Against the Arms Trade.
Yes, but I mean, they're
on
not
a smaller scale than the IRA.
I don't think they're entirely comparable.
Nobody was hurt.
Well, indeed, that's right.
The point is, hit them in the pocket.
Yes, but at the same time, it may well be that this, you know, what's happened has happened. They've done what they've done. They're not part of Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Doesn't condone or condemn what they're doing. But they're, you know, Palestine Action isn't Palestine Solidarity Campaign. It just isn't.
What do you think of it as a tactic, though?
Well, I think if we'd done it to Elbit Systems, which is a private Israeli arms company, nobody would have cared. The problem with attacking Barclays banks like this is that lots of people are Barclays customers, and you're inconveniencing them. So you're not necessarily going to persuade them by doing that, are you? Let's face it.
Well, I think maybe it will make people think. And I mean, this the link between Barclays and Elbit Systems and the genocide is kind of hidden, isn't it? Many people have got Barclays bank account, and it hadn't even passed across their mind.
Well, I think Barclays have also been chosen because they were singled out during the apartheid era as big supporters of apartheid.
They've been chosen because of this report. This report, yeah. I just mentioned, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Anyway, talking of the various lobbies out there, why don't we now go to Wales and to Hedley Rees, who I hope is joining us on the line. Are you there, Hedley?
Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you. So your article this week caught my eye, and this in a way is an ongoing, I suppose it's a theme of this programme, which is fascism, which is where you get big corporations who just completely control what is supposed to be the public regulators. Now, we've seen all this kind of thing going on all over the place. One of the most obvious ones is with the telecommunications industry, where you've got this EU telecom body, which is now the regulator and effectively the regulator for the UK too, which is just basically staffed by the industry itself. So the same is true, I think, isn't it, in the pharmaceutical industry. You came out with an article about this the MHRA. Now, do you want to just start off and tell us what the MHRA stands for and how they came into being, and maybe a bit about the system before them?
Yeah, sure, Tony. So MHRA stands for Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency. That means it's a competent authority with delegated authority from government to regulate medicines and healthcare products. Now, the three main responsibilities are to license products for sales, so medicines and medical devices, etc., for sale, to inspect the facilities that are producing, manufacturing the products, that is to send inspectors along physically and to go through the site from beginning to end, looking in all the nooks and crannies and writing a report on what they've found and raising issues if they do find them. And the third one is to monitor the safety of medicines. So those are the three responsibilities they have. But they don't have the staff to do that. All the good people have left. I know that because I've worked with good people at the MHRA when I co-chaired a conference in Cincinnati, which was co-sponsored by FDA. We used to have senior MHRA inspectors on the panel every year. But from maybe, say, 2015 onwards, they've all left, and we've just got inexperienced young people who do not have the skills, certainly, to approve drugs, and they, I don't believe they have the skills to actually inspect facilities. And those inspections through COVID were distance inspections, which mean they didn't ever go there.
Now, look, most people know that during COVID, a lot of these checks, basically the quality control, was dropped. The idea was we want a vaccine as soon as possible. So why are you complaining? Surely that was the whole point, is that let's just let them produce these vaccines and get on with it. We don't need delays that might be caused by quality control.
Yeah, well, if we took that approach in the aircraft industry or the automotive industry or the nuclear industry, it would be absolutely catastrophic.
Well, I mean, Boeing, it seems, do in the aircraft industry.
Well, yes, but only, I mean, Boeing did what the pharmaceutical industry did, was to outsource the design of its products to third parties, and that's what pharmaceuticals have done. They did that with the Dreamliner, but it was such a disaster. There was an 18-month overrun and like a $2 billion overspend because no one was coordinating all the contractors and suppliers, and Boeing had to move back to the more orthodox model of keeping the design and development in-house so that you've got control of the whole thing. Pharmaceutical companies have got no control over the supply chain whatsoever. It's all outsourced to third-party contractors. These are commercial organizations like Lonza in Switzerland, Catalan Pharma Solutions in the US, and Oxford Biomedica in the UK. Is that making sense, Tony?
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I'm also wondering, is there really, even when the MHR are supposed to be doing their jobs, any difference between injected medicines and the safety standards and, say, oral medicines or medicines that are just applied to your skin, or is it all just treated the same?
No, it's very different. These injections, A, they're what is known as biologics, which means they are made from living organisms. So they are very, very sensitive to temperature changes. You can regard them as, you know, a human. If someone put you in a house that was, you know, below freezing, then you wouldn't be long before you wouldn't be with us. But it's the same with these biologics. They can die very easily and become inert, and even they can become toxic. But the other thing with injection, they have to be sterile. They have to be proven that when the doctor gets the vial with the vaccine in it, it's not been tampered with, it's not been touched. He just inserts his needle, a syringe, he draws out 20 mil, 30 mil, and he injects that into the patient. Now, particularly with the Pfizer-BioNTech injections and the Moderna injections, they were frozen down to either minus 70 degrees C or minus 20 degrees C and then shipped into vaccination centers for the people there to finish them off. And they had to do very significant manufacturing operations to do that. They had to thaw the vaccines down from minus 70 degrees C to refrigerated temperature, plus 2 degrees C to plus 8 degrees C. Now, that in itself is can be an incredibly dangerous operation if it's not carried out to standard operation procedures with people who are skilled in the process. So you could turn a molecule that is stable when it's down at minus 70 degrees C, say, into something that is toxic. And then, of course, there were 5 doses in the vial. So in the vaccination centres, they had to insert saline diluent into the vial and then mix it up by turning it over 10 times. Now, when you mix, again, that is a crucial manufacturing operation, because if you don't do it properly to defined conditions, you could get hot spots or you could actually affect the structure of the molecular structure. So there's so many things that could go wrong. And this all happened inside vaccination centres, some of them within car parks. So people were injected with what were going to be non-sterile products. Yeah. They could not have been sterile.
Well, look, so, one of the key things about this MHRA is, and I know, you know, and in your article in the Daily Skeptic, you make the point that actually they don't say what they've done. So they may have been doing inspections, for example, on the AstraZeneca premises, but they're not making them public.
Well, what I should say there, Tona, it's not AstraZeneca that do these. For the AstraZeneca vaccines, it's a company called Oxford Biomedica, which is what they call a contract development.
Ah, right. So, yeah, okay. So that's the drug. But, you know, I mean, if you're going to have a regulator, they need to obviously publish, make it very obvious to the public what the results of the inspections and what inspections they're doing, surely.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And really, if you look at, or if you talk to people who've submitted, you know, freedom of information requests to MHRA, you just as well give up, you know, 6 years of your life before you get a decent answer out of them, because, you know, they are not answering people's questions. And when we look at the board, touching on something you said earlier about fascism, the board of MHRA is heavily conflicted. You know, you've got people from Microsoft on there. You've got people from Imperial College on there. You know, you've got numbers of organizations on the board who attend the board meeting every month. They get inside information on what FDA are doing, and they cannot be independent and objective.
Well, it sounds to me like they're basically spying on the regulator in order to make sure that they can dodge any criticism and inspection. But then there's also this week been this amazing article in The Telegraph, which was pulled from The Telegraph, no doubt because of legal threats. The headline is, "Celebrity doctors promoted COVID vaccines without declaring payments. TV viewers were not told that they had previously received thousands of pounds, sometimes five-figure sums, from AstraZeneca." And I'll put a copy of the article up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The pharmaceutical watchdog, in big inverted commas, sounds like a fox rather than a wolf, this one, has been urged to investigate after a string of celebrity doctors took part in discussions about the COVID vaccine but failed to declare they'd been paid by AstraZeneca. In recent weeks, several high-profile doctors took part in debates about the company's vaccine on primetime TV shows, but viewers were not informed that they had previously received thousands of pounds from the pharmaceutical giant. In April, AstraZeneca admitted for the first time in court documents that its COVID vaccine can cause a rare and dangerous side effect. The following month, it emerged that Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine was being withdrawn worldwide. These revelations, although they tried to make it that there was no connection between the two, the revelations prompted a fresh round of debate about the vaccine, with celebrity doctors invited on to television shows to discuss the fallout. Dr. Ranj Singh, who regularly appears on the BBC as a talking head, was paid £22,500 by AstraZeneca, according to records from the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry. He led led a discussion on the BBC Breakfast Show Morning Live about the safety of AstraZeneca and the vaccine and the serious but rare complications associated with it. He failed to declare his payments from the pharmaceutical giant to either the BBC or to interviewers. A BBC spokesman said they were unaware of the payments. The segment on AstraZeneca COVID vaccine was balanced and covered reported risks and benefits. Dr. Nigat Arif, who became a familiar face on TV during the pandemic, including BBC Breakfast, was paid £10,000 by AstraZeneca. In April, he appeared on ITV's This Morning to discuss possible side effects of the AstraZeneca vaccine as blood clots and side effects such as blood clots, and reassured people these are very, very rare. Now, quite how rare that is. An ITV spokesman said Dr. Arif's analysis was fair, accurate, and balanced. So this does seem to be these are spin doctors, really. They're not the medical doctors, Edley.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to be clear, the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry is the trade association that represents AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, and hundreds of other pharmaceutical companies. So it's not a regulator. It has for many years had a code of practice, and one of the key elements of that is that you can never say openly that a medicine is safe. You know, you are banned from saying that. And the other thing is, if you are going to pay anyone, like clinical trial investigators or these people, or these doctors on TV, you have to declare that. And so Pfizer, AstraZeneca should have declared that they had paid these people money. So the article is right in that sense, in that they should have had their wrists slapped for not declaring this. The only penalty is that they could be ejected from the ABPI as members. And I can remember in my early career, Bayer, who I worked for, were ejected for the period because they were allegedly providing televisions to doctors. And that is a sort of case in point. So the code of practice is very clear on behaviours of pharmaceutical companies, and we've just seen it go up in smoke.
Yeah, so how do we tell if somebody is being paid by the pharmaceutical industry? I mean, it seems to me what's happened here is you've got news bulletins and current affairs programmes with people on there who are actually trying to sell a product rather than to discuss people's health.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, this is, I've been shouting at the TV screen for 3 years because you look at these shows, you don't know who's the expert. You know, a doctor's never the expert. When these injections are manufactured, it's the supply chain that has to be understood, because it's what the supply chain produces that goes into the patient's arm. There's nothing about science. It's the grunt and grind of making the drug substance, making the drug product, then shipping that into the distribution center, making sure it's properly handled. It goes to the pharmacy and the doctor's surgery, and the patient takes it or it's administered to the patient. We don't know what happened with these injections. Certainly, they didn't go via the licensed wholesale network that we have in the UK. This is companies like AAH and Alliance Healthcare. You see their vans pulling up at pharmacies. They did not handle these injections, and we don't know who did. I've got an inkling of who did, but they would not have been licensed to the extent required for good distribution practice. So there, immediately, we have a huge compliance issue, which MHRA is just ignoring. It's as if it never happened. So, you know, people just aren't able, because they don't have the information, to look beneath the science and the medicine doctors. You know, do not understand how supply chains work. They do not understand how drugs are developed. They do not understand pharmacovigilance. They don't understand drug metabolism and pharmacokinetics, all those sorts of things that need to be applied when you develop a drug. And
now, I was part of this, in a way still am, group holding the line, a group of journalists that were very critical of the pharmaceutical industry and the press collusion during COVID. And one of the organisations that was really in our sights was this thing called the Science Media Centre, which was initially set up by the Royal Institution. Martin, do you know anything about the RI, Royal Institution? Who are these people? It's a kind of it's said to be royal, but it's a scientific body of some kind.
Well, if it's what I'm thinking of, it's the you know, the Royal Institution is the institution that was set up in Charles II's time originally. If it's the same one,
a sort of Enlightenment type.
Yes, I mean, it was, yes. So in other words, it's
1799. It was set up.
All right, so it's not
a bit later.
It's not the one I'm thinking.
Communicating scientific issues to the general public through its events, including those aimed at children and schools and other activities. So that's who they actually are. But it was quite clear that the Science Media Centre was funded by things like the Gates Foundation. They're just looking into the controversy around them. They were very powerful people. They had all the sort of personal phone numbers of all the health correspondents in London. And they were very much lobbying for the pharmaceutical industry when it came to various policies to do with COVID. Within months of its launch, the Science Media Centre was already embroiled in a controversy over its activities on the issue of genetically modified foods. It stood accused of operating a sort of Mandelsonian rapid rebuttal unit, of employing some of the clumsiest spin techniques of New Labour. And this is in order to try to allay fears about genetically modified foods. The Dr. David Miller, who's our Bristol sociologist, who was sacked for his explaining that the Israeli government was behind some of the student groups that have been criticising him up at Bristol University, is of the what is called the Sterling Media Research Institute. He's among the Science Media Centre's critics. He's quoted in an, and by the way, David also created this excellent website called SpinWatch. In an article in The Guardian, is saying the Science Media Centre is not as independent as it appears. It was set up to provide an accurate, independent scientific information for the media, but its views are largely in line with government scientific policy. The SMC made much of its charitable status, yet its charity number is the same as that for the Royal Institution. In other words, it's almost synonymous with the RI. Similarly, its independence was supposed to be guaranteed by the fact that no more than 5% of its funding comes from any one source, yet 70% of its funding comes from business, which could be said to have similar interests. The SMC has since had the .ac.uk removed from its email address after complaints that only academic institutions that were not corporate funded were entitled to these, and that was then upheld. So you've also got this enormous SMC lobbying group pushing the pharmaceutical industry's ideas and the official government Department for Health ideas through the press, Headley.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, we've got all these self-appointed and elected bodies now that have set themselves up as experts or representing something that really has a hidden agenda behind it. You've got Gavi, the vaccine alliances. You've got the Sage Group. You've got all these bodies. How do you know that they know what they're talking about? You don't. And because there's so much money behind them to be able to, get on the mainstream media and, get themselves in front of decision makers, there's no way of actually putting your hand up and saying, hang on, those people are talking a load of, nonsense. And I'll tell you why they're talking nonsense, because A, B, C, D, you can't do that. And, yeah, so it's frustrating, Tony, I have to say.
Well, just looking to today and to the future, well, I say today, it's actually Wednesday, a news story saying that global mRNA cancer vaccines, clinical trials market report 2024, the first commercial mRNA vaccine approval is expected by 2029. This is a news release in Dublin. The global mRNA cancer vaccines clinical trials and market future outlook 2024 drug pipelines have been added to researchatmarket.com's offering. So these vaccines, it seems, are coming pretty soon. From that time, skin cancer apparently are dominating, with 10 different vaccines being offered for that. US and China are dominating the mRNA cancer vaccines clinical trials. They've got 45 different vaccines. The first commercial mRNA vaccine approval is expected by 2029, as I said, and the clinical trials insight by company and country and indication and phase. That's what the press release is all about. So from that time, Impetuous, when mRNA vaccines were utilized for the management of coronavirus in 2019, actually it was 2021 really, but anyway, clinical researchers are working insistently with the intention of using mRNA vaccines for the treatment of cancer ailments. Now, anyone that's offered this sort of treatment or a trial, Hedley, what would you say to them to make some sort of guarantees, if possible, about their safety? Because you're telling me that the coronavirus, the much of the safety regime was ripped up.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that most people don't know is that the MHRA in January 2022 changed their regulations so that they could manufacture these mRNA injections in the hospital, in a hospital pharmacy. And I know Imperial College are running a trial, and it's complete nonsense because these supply chains are absolutely dangerous. It's not just there are things like lipid nanoparticles in them and aluminium and all these sorts of things, but also a hospital cannot have the skills to carry out aseptic, sterile processing of products that then are going to go into a patient's body. This is dangerous, it's going to kill people, and they don't seem to care. And so cancer's always been the holy grail, you know. If we can get, there's 200, 300 different types of cancers. And what I would say is that BioNTech, who worked with Pfizer, I've just done a Substack post on that. Their first drug in about 2012 was in melanoma, skin cancer. And suddenly they have sort of like grown from the size of your corner shop to one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world, based on smoke and mirrors. It's all smoke and mirrors, Tony. And, you know, I can prove that chapter and verse.
Can you, in a nutshell, explain how these mRNA vaccines work? Because there was a certain amount of scepticism about the idea of that it might create autoimmune diseases by injecting the body into a little cell or whatever it is, a virus, a vaccine, that will start to manufacture poisons inside your body. And we heard from Dr. Stanley Laham straight away that, that there's a real possibility here. And he's an expert on these autoimmune diseases and discovered one of the AIDS-like viruses back in the 1970s. He's saying that by injecting yourself with something which is actually going to manufacture a spike protein or something to trigger your immune system, what you're doing is you're stoking up the potential for these cells or whatever they are to stay in your body and just start churning out poisons within your body. So what do you make of the whether this technology for COVID, it might be transferable over to fighting cancer?
Well, it's all theory, isn't it? You know, when you put a drug into a person's body, you cannot predict with a theory what it's going to do to the individual. Each individual is different. And something I must say, Tony, here is that the AstraZeneca vaccine, as I mentioned, was made by Oxford Biomedica in Cowley in Oxford. They also make the similar drug substance. Instead of an adenovirus, this is a lentiviral vector that goes into a product that Novartis launched in 2017 called Kymria, and it was $475,000 when it launched. The side effects are neurological toxicities and cytokine release syndrome, and FDA has put a bold warning on all the labeling, and it's also just added potentially it can cause cancer as well. So the company that made the AstraZeneca vaccine also makes one that's on the market that we know is highly toxic. So that in itself says that these injections basically are dangerous, because the evidence is there. What the industry has done is they've taken these injections, what is called CAR T therapy for rare blood cancers. It's specific to the individual patient, and the theory is you take the patient's cells out of you extract the patient's cells, you extract the T cells, and then you send that off to the manufacturer, who genetically modifies the patient's cell T cells so that they are potentially curative. And then that goes back to the hospital and they are reinfused into the patient. It's the world's most complex supply chain, and is more likely to kill the patient than cure them.
God. I mean, it just sounds a little bit like there's a dream of some kind of miracle cure that's being sold here, rather than any kind of real procedure. And obviously, that they hope to make a lot of money out of this. Just finally, though, in April, as I mentioned, AstraZeneca admitted that the COVID vaccine can cause a rare and dangerous side effect. But then the following month, apparently completely separately, it emerged that the vaccine was being withdrawn worldwide. Now, AstraZeneca is saying there's no connection between the two, Hedley.
Well, the evidence is out there about the blood clots. And as far as I can see, with the vaccine engine, the work they're doing, it's not rare at all. But it's not just the blood clots. There's a whole range of things linked to the issue that I've just mentioned. And to be honest, what AstraZeneca should be doing is recalling these vaccines. And I've sent an open letter to the new chair of the MHRA to say, even though they've stopped selling the vaccines, the supply chain is still active. You know, supply chain, the producers of raw materials and starting materials have to work 2 years ahead of when the finished product is made due to lead times. You know, the things that you expect in the car industry, you know, this is like any other supply chain. So you can't just withdraw from the market and not clean up the mess that you left. You know, there'll be companies making lipid nanoparticles, all the other components that went into the injections. They'll be all over the world. MHRA has the power to issue a recall, to say, AstraZeneca, you are the marketing authorization holders for these products. You have to recall them from the distributors, from the hospitals, the pharmacies, everywhere these have gone since you've been selling this drug.
Well, did you know what? They're probably going to ignore you, aren't they?
Oh, well, yes, but it's attritional, isn't it? The more people realise this and the more you go on about it, that's the approach I'm taking. Just keep sharing the truth, and eventually something gives.
Well, it may be that AstraZeneca have just taken a look at the bottom line and saying, well, people aren't actually they're not taking up these vaccines anyway, so we may as well just withdraw them.
Yeah, but they are. Yeah, absolutely. They're not making any money out of it, and they don't want to be exposed to any product liability, because there is a product liability aspect to this as well, because these are defective products. You know, they've been selling defective products to people in the UK. So a good lawyer in product liability should be able to take AstraZeneca to the cleaners on this, because the evidence is there.
Well, maybe they will. Anyway, Hedley, where can people follow you online? What's the best place?
The best place is my Substack called Inside Pharma. If you Google Substack Inside Pharma, it's 2.5 years of evidence of supply chain malfeasance across the whole of Big Pharma. when you read that, you will fully appreciate what's been going on. And you can tell, you'll be able to explain to the people that you know, because people have not really understood. But when you get the proper facts, then it's much easier to explain.
And I mean, if you were in charge of the MHRA, what would you do?
Well, I've so much. But, oh, gosh. The board is corrupt, I have to say that. But I would bring the people who've left back. I'd stop having the industry having to fund. If you look at the prices MHRA charges for various services, that the sort of pharma industry is paying for the MHRA. So I'd take away that dependence on the pharma funding MHRA. The government has to go back and fund that organisation, and the same across all the regulators, and bring back the good people who become consultants in the industry.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me like you've been in the front line, really, fighting fascism, actually, in the way that these big companies have just decided that it's their regulation. Anyway, look, Hedley Rees, fascinating. Thanks ever so much for that little... I mean, we don't revisit COVID that much on here, but, I mean, the thing is that there's all these other... new types of mRNA or new medical technologies coming in on the back of it. So even though people have decided they don't necessarily want a COVID vaccine anymore, and that COVID isn't anywhere near as important as it used to be, it's not really even replacing flu, and there's a lot more people maybe sceptical now about using vaccines, the fact is they'll come along with another thing. And I mean my own suspicion is about the King's cancer, that this is an idea that, you know, we were here at some point, oh, the King's getting some sort of amazing mRNA treatment, and therefore the whole country needs it too. Anyway, Hedley Rees, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tony. Thank you so much.
From the letter to the Hebrews. Now Christ has come as the high priest of all the blessings which were to come. He has passed through the greater, the more perfect tent, which is better than one made by men's hands, because it is not of this created order. And he has entered the sanctuary once and for all, taking with him not the blood of goats and bull calves, but his own blood, having won an eternal redemption for us. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer are sprinkled on those who have incurred defilement, and they restore the holiness of their outward lives. How much more effectively the blood of Christ, who has offered himself as the perfect sacrifice to God through the eternal Spirit, can purify our inner self from dead actions, so that we do our service to the living God. He brings a new covenant as the mediator, only so that the people who were called to an eternal inheritance may actually receive what was promised. His death took place to cancel the sins that infringed the earlier covenant. The word of the Lord.
Finishing off there with Stereolab, one of my favourite bands, and old mate of mine, John, actually went out with one of the girls from Stereolab. I was most impressed. And it's sort of the La Resistance, but it's not called that from 1995. It's actually called French Disco. Several really good songs that they've done over the years. Then we had a bit from the RTE, the Irish State Broadcasters Sunday Service. And before that, Put Your Hand in the Hand from 1971. Gosh, there's loads of those sorts of songs around in the charts. Well, we don't even have proper charts anymore, but that was Ocean, Put Your Hand in the Hand. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll start straight away with Putin and the other economic summit, what we used to call TOES, which would shadow the G7. But actually what's really going on, Martin, is you've got the World Economic Forum, which is a major focus for the deep state and the elite, their attempt at controlling the world in this kind of massive corporate state. This is the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, SPIEF. It doesn't really roll off the tongue. I think they should call it the Economic Summit. They can just call it SPIES. So it's much easier to remember SPIES in St. Petersburg, and the West can demonize them and we can have a laugh. But how does these two organizations, that and the WEF, contrast?
Well, there was probably at one stage, some years ago, quite a lot of overlap between the people who have attended both of them. But I think now with sanctions on Russia, a lot of the West European based companies and US people won't go to the St. Petersburg for this forum. But of course, there's plenty of people from the rest of the world there looking to do business with the Russians, because the world economy is bifurcating now. I don't know if you saw today, of course, the G7 have just agreed that they're going to take the interest from the money they've stolen from the Russian Central Bank and give it to Zelensky, supposedly for weapons, although I doubt whether it'll ever actually get, it's basically, they're going to give this money to the American military-industrial complex as a subsidy.
Well, it's like it's raining cash, isn't it? As everyone's dying, there's raining cash around them.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, most of the money that the Russians held in the West was held in banks in Belgium. And the Belgians aren't happy at all because they're not represented in the G7. So this decision by the G7 that we're going to use this money for this purpose, the Belgian banks and the Belgian government aren't very happy about it because, as far as they're concerned, they haven't been consulted.
Let's go straight then to, well, actually, no, let's just, because you brought this up, let's look at the Russian response. Their response is, why don't we have a peace deal? We'll just keep these four regions of Ukraine, which are largely Russian-speaking, which we've been fighting about, and then you can carry on with all the rest, and as long as Ukraine doesn't join NATO, that's it, end of the war.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether that is what the Russians are saying.
It is, yeah.
Well, what I suspect is going on is that there are elements within the policy debate in the West who want it to be the case that the Russians are asking for some kind of negotiation.
Okay, so let's just get it straight. Putin today has made a public peace offer to Ukraine. The Russians need to said there could be immediate pause to hostilities. Laid out four conditions for Ukraine that he said would lead to an immediate ceasefire, ultimately an end to the conflict. According to the Kremlin, Kyiv's natural, non-aligned, non-nuclear status and the lifting of all Western sanctions are necessary conditions for ending the conflict. In a speech to the Russian Foreign Ministry today, Putin said, if Ukraine withdraws its forces from the four regions annexed by Moscow, Lugansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia and Kherson, then he will order a halt to operations and begin negotiations to end the war.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably politically very sensible for the Russians to make such an
offer. What about the timing?
Well, I mean, the thing is, what's going to happen is that's not going to happen. So in a sense, there's an element of
why not?
Why? Because the Western powers will not allow... Can you see the Ukrainians withdrawing from the four oblasts? They're going to be driven out of them anyway.
Well, they're already driven out of almost all of two of them, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they are. I think that this is the way I read this, is this is the Russians being quite sensible, offering an off-ramp to the West. But the West won't take it for all the reasons which we could go into.
Well, we will be going into them.
Well, okay, well, let's go into them in a minute.
Okay.
But I mean, the point is that the I think that public opinion in Russia is increasingly coming to the view that they've just got to finish this off and get it done.
What I'd like
and
to
they
do. Don't,
they're not looking for any peace agreement.
It's to dip into this plenary session from last Friday evening over in St. Petersburg, where we have these two characters, Vladimir Putin and Sergei Karaganov. Karaganov. With a V on the end, Karaganov. He's well, people call him a bit of a hawk. He's saying that the Russians should just weigh in every time that they should be much more heavy-handed in Ukraine. There is an argument for that, surely, Martin?
Well, it's certainly being made in Russia. Is Karaganov a journalist or a politician?
Neither. Commentator.
All right, so he's a journalist then, in other words. He's not no political role. He's not a member of parliament. He's not a minister. He's just somebody with an opinion.
So what do you think of that opinion?
I follow
Putin is being too dovish, he should be more...
Well, I mean, if you follow what goes on in Russia, as I try to do, you will know that Putin, in fact, is regarded as a moderate in Russian terms. There are plenty of people who think that Putin's a bit too kids'
okay,
clumsy.
So he's a political... Let's just get him straight. He's a political scientist. Karaganov is a political scientist who heads the Council for Foreign and Defence Policy, Security Analytics Institution, founded by Vitaly Sirikov.
So he's a kind of academic commentator then. Yeah. Okay.
Dean of the Faculty of World Economy as well, somewhere. But anyway, interesting character. So this, what we're going to be listening to now is a bit of a tit for tat between the two of them at this plenary session last Friday evening. And we start off with Putin.
In terms of nuclear escalation, we've never started this rhetoric. I can't remember that lady. She was the Prime Minister of United Kingdom. When she became Prime Minister, she said that she was prepared to press the nuclear button. We never said this. We never said this. And this is where it all began. We responded to this, that you have to be more serious about this. And we never brandish our nuclear weapons. And application or non-application of nuclear weapons. We've got a nuclear doctrine, and it's all in there. I spoke with these heads of these information agencies. I said that everything is written there. The application of these weapons can be... it's an exceptional case where territorial integrity of the Russian Federation is threatened. I don't think we've got that exceptional case yet. However, we are very carefully monitoring what's happening in the world with us and around us, and we accept the possibility that we would introduce some changes into this military doctrine. As for agreement on... this was signed and ratified. Americans never ratified, and we've recalled that ratification. That's on testing the nuclear weapons. And if we need to, we will revoke that ratification. As for the speed and the results, you said that there's a great responsibility on me. Yes, that's true. We can increase the speed of resolving the issues that we have ahead of us. However, that's in direct proportion with the level of losses. And what is being proposed by the Chief General and Ministry of Defense is very important. However, what's more important is taking care of lives and health of our guys that are fighting in at the front line. There's military work that is being done since the start of this year. We've liberated 47 villages and towns. 870 square kilometers have been liberated. We are pushing out the enemy from the territory. and the General Staff, Ministry of Defense have got certain plans, and we're confident that they will be implemented, that they will be realized.
Well, there he is, speaking at that plenary session. Quite a lot of people at this, I think possibly quite a bit more than the World Economic Forum. Just looking at the figures, it's 19,000 people actually come along to this big St. Petersburg gathering. One of them that's not there is Scott Ritter, because he had his passport taken away when he was heading over there beginning of last week. But he's saying there, Martin, a couple of things, I think, which are quite significant. One is that we're now looking at changing our nuclear doctrine, number one. And number two, we're now looking at, if we need to, we will be testing nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, the existing nuclear doctrine is one thing. And, of course, he's suggesting that if the West continues to the brinkmanship that they seem determined on, then we will reconsider our nuclear doctrine.
I mean, as we go here in a minute, he's saying that actually they've got a pretty good early warning system, a lot better than the West has got, apparently. And so, therefore, there is a temptation for them to use nuclear weapons just as to give a warning, thinking and maybe knowing that they won't be hit as bad as the West in a nuclear exchange.
Well, I think what he's hinting at there is the possibility of, say, for example, nuking Britain, which then puts the United States in a, because the United States could retaliate for that by and nuke Russia, but then the United States gets nuked. Yeah, so you can see that they could pick off an individual country which has caused problems for them, especially if it's further away from Russia. You know, you don't want to choose anywhere too close, do you? Like Germany, and the obvious place to choose would be Britain.
Yeah,
so if you're going to do stupid things like that, it would be because
NATO weapons are being used to hit Russia. It's quite obvious to the Russians that this is NATO they're fighting, not Ukraine. Anyway, let's go over to the response now from Sergei Karaganov and what he has to say after that.
Nevertheless, we understand that nuclear escalation can save lots of lives, because it can bring sense back to our enemies. We've got this nuclear doctrine, and I'm sure that it will be changed. Will be changed in the nearest future, and you will have the right. You will have the right. You will receive the right to respond with a nuclear strike against any strike, any type of strike against our country. And this is the right of our head of state, should be the right of head of state. And I think that change in our doctrine will cool down the heads of our enemies. Maybe it's too early to go towards nuclear escalation. However, maybe our enemies have gone crazy. Like Americans are more careful. They're feeding Ukrainians to these meat grinders, and the Europeans are going to this war the third time. They're going against us. So, if a pack of dogs or hyenas attacks you, and you've got a stick, then you can use it to scare them away. But maybe they will tear your trousers and then bite your legs and then will eat you. But if you can shoot a couple of them, then they will run away.
Sergei Karaganov there, he's using a metaphor to talk about conventional weapons, using a stick and then a gun to shoot a couple of the dogs, and then the rest will run away. He's also saying that a nuclear strike will cool down their enemies.
I think what I got from him saying is, if we threaten to do a nuclear strike, that will cool their heads. rather, but of course I know, because I remembered who he is, he's one of those that's been pushing for Russia to use nuclear weapons, which I presume is why he's been put up to debate with Putin. That's not Putin's position. And I think
Hearing from Putin in a minute.
Yeah.
But the point is that he is up there. He's up there with the president of Zimbabwe and Colombia up on the front, on the top panel at this conference. Yeah. We've heard virtually nothing about this. He's saying, they're continuing to feed Ukrainians into this meat grinder, he describes it. He's also talking about this is the third time they've come for us. Now, I imagine he's talking here about Napoleon and Hitler beforehand.
Yeah, I think that's the way in which, public opinion in Russia is seeing this conflict.
It's Russophobia, basically. For some reason, the West can't control the Russians, and so they want to just destroy them. That's Operation Beluga and regime change. We've got to get rid of these people.
Yes.
But they're not going to, are they? It's quite clear they're not going
to. No, they're not. Which is why they don't need to panic. They're winning.
Also, he's talking about, actually, Putin was mentioning the amount of territory they've taken, these 47 towns and 870 square kilometres. I don't know what that is in miles. Gosh, must be about 200 square miles in the just since the beginning of this year, so in the last 6 months or so. At the moment, if they don't do anything, the Russians will take these bits of territory, won't they?
That's right.
And they're pushing further in as the West provides the Ukrainians with longer-range weapons.
Well, the danger with these longer-range weapons, some of them are nuclear-capable. So when they fire into Russia with one of these weapons, it's probably just got a conventional warhead on it. But you can't, the problem is a lot of these things are interoperable. So you can't presume that it's a conventional warhead.
Anyway, quite an interesting comment, this idea of, you hit them with sticks, and then if they still don't go away, you shoot a couple of the dogs in the head, and the other ones get the idea and run off. Well, to me, that is it seems to be his doctrine about nuclear strikes will cool them down. Anyway, let's see what Putin's response was to that after there was rather raucous laughter in the audience, which you can't hear here, but you could see it on the video.
President Mnangagwa maybe knows how to deal with hyenas. Do you agree with me that it's the way you deal with hyenas? No, we've got our own. In Europe.
That's Putin really talking about the European hyenas, and NATO, effectively. He's saying are hyenas.
Well, I mean, that's the way they perceive it. For obvious reasons. I mean, they've tried to bend over backwards to negotiate some deal about this from 2014 onwards, and they've just been given the runaround. So they've had enough. They're fed up with all these people trying to make mess. It's not surprising, is it?
This is what Sergei Karaganov riposted after Putin said that.
I'd like to maybe reiterate this question. If we are more decisive in terms of escalation, maybe God showed us the path. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, and that story is there, through that. Fire rain they were destroyed.
Yeah, so he's invoking this idea of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's saying basically that the West is so decadent, corrupt, that in fact this is the sort of rhetoric that was around a lot in the Soviet era, that maybe their decadence and their corruption will be the end of them, and they will just burn, and they will have to burn. He's also here suggesting, I mean, this is part of the comments that was also made at this about the British saying, well, we don't need to nuke Britain because it's destroying itself from within. I mean, he's describing a West, and particularly Britain, they're aiming at as part of this, which isn't in that specific clip, but it's elsewhere in the talk that they had last Friday, that Britain is so dysfunctional and it's in the business of eating itself, so they won't waste a nuclear weapon on us.
Well, I mean, this stuff is it's political rhetoric. That's what it is.
I'm so shocked by it. Well, not shocked. No, it's impossible to be shocked. Kevin Carr is quite right these days. Is the fact that there's none of this is reported. These discussions at this international forum with 20,000 diplomats and various people from around the world, business people, etc., from all over the world. And this is the way that the West is being really just, they're just poking fun at the West and saying they're totally incompetent idiots and they're trying to have a war with us, and if they actually push this, they're going to lose.
Well, they are going to lose, but I don't think I don't think it's at all helpful to be blasé about the use of nuclear weapons. It makes you sound childish, because, of course, you can't. The only use of nuclear weapons is to blow everything up in one go.
So, but that's the only reason to use it. Martin, there is a purpose here of having Karaganov and Putin up on the platform, isn't there? There are these two various different points of view. Karaganov is saying, we need to seize the initiative by upping the game, you know, saying, look, if we have the initiative, then it'd be like a kind of chess game. We will be ahead of them. They'll have to react to us rather than the other way around.
Well, that may be so, but I don't think childish threats to use nuclear weapons are very helpful. The traditional...
But isn't that normal when they're being poked, the bear is being poked, where Russian cities are being bombed as under the guise of this being about Ukraine?
Well, when you said it was what you said a minute ago about how this is back to the Soviet era style rhetoric, in the Soviet era, they were quite clear, we will never use nuclear weapons in a first strike. If you attack us, that's why we've got them.
So how have we...
It's because you've got them.
How have we turned that round?
Well, what we've done is we've ripped up all of the deals that we did with the communists. We did loads of deals with Gorbachev.
Well, Scott Ritter did as well,
and with people before Gorbachev. Yeah? The ABM treaty was signed long before Gorbachev came along. And gradually, over a period of time, an element of trust was built up between NATO and the Soviets. And loads of treaties were signed, for example, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the START treaty to limit strategic weapons. And what's happened is the West completely, gratuitously, has ripped all those treaties up. And they were treaties that we were happy to make with the totalitarian communists, but apparently the democratic Russian government are not a reasonable partner to hold these treaties down.
Whether King Charles, Macron, Biden have a Netanyahu mindset, it's like, well, sod them all. Let's just have a war.
Well, I think the attitude is that they just will not accept Russia as an equal partner in negotiations about anything. They've just got to be submissive,
it's
and that's
as if
it.
Their thinking is fueled by hatred of Russia, not by any kind of anything constructive. They've run out of ideas, but they still all know how to hate the Russians.
There's an element of hatred and Russophobia, of course, especially in the media. But underlying all of this is what they really want, which is to control the resources in Siberia and then lay siege to China, which is what they really want. You know, China is regarded as the big economic threat. And, you know, we could go into the wider
question.
So
this is what they're saying, you think, that we'll knock down the Russians and then we'll go for China?
Yes, but they're also saying it out loud and the Russians and Chinese can hear them. You know, it's not really that smart to say it all out loud, is it? Even if that's what you want to do.
What idiotic leaders we've got. Anyway, the final part of this little 10-minute session altogether is 3 or 4 minutes with Putin saying what he thinks about this whole idea of, you know, let's go up to just start nuking them and hopefully they'll pay attention.
So maybe that part of humanity that lost its belief in God and also lost its mind now. Maybe we could do this without me. They're scared now. Look at this. And of course, maybe we can think about Europeans. Anything is possible. If, God forbid, it goes to certain strikes, we have to understand, we have early notification systems. We've got that. Nowhere else in the world do they have that system, early notification system. So they're defenseless in this sense. That's number one. Second, is the power of the strikes. Our tactical nuclear weapons is 3-4 times more powerful than what the Americans used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In terms of numbers, we've got several fold more. Even if the Americans bring things to Europe, we've got several times more. But if, God forbid, this comes to this, God forbid it comes to this, then you said we will reduce the victims. However, they could also rise to infinity. Also, these Europeans will have to think if those with whom we are exchanging these strikes, if Americans get involved on a strategic level, I doubt very much. I think Europeans should think about it. I doubt that Americans will get involved. But I'm confident that it will never come to this, and we do not have that need for this. Our military are gaining experience, they are gaining competence. Our military-industrial complex is demonstrating its efficiency. I spoke about this many times. I think we've increased the production of ammunition by 20 times. We are manifold greater in terms of our capabilities, in terms of aviation. We are significantly stronger in terms of tanks, and so on and so forth. So we don't even have the need to think about this. So I just would like to ask you not to mention this unnecessarily.
So that's Putin winding up that clip. And I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you fancy perusing that, particularly that plenary session from the St. Petersburg International Economic Summit, I like to call it. Actually, they call it a forum, where you've got 20,000 or so of the world's leading people, individuals, businesses, governments, diplomats, and all sorts there, looking at what is going on in the world. And they increasingly, Martin, seem to be rooting for the Russians and thinking that this is a more stable economy and a more stable government than the West.
Well, they're certainly not saying we're not going to go because the Americans have told us not to. And they, you know, increasingly, that's the case. I think what Putin said at the end there, I think, is exactly right. Karaganov, if that's his name, is a bit of a blowhard to the point of not being helpful. And as he pointed out, we don't need to talk about this. If there's a nuclear war, there's a nuclear war, we'll all be dead. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about winning a conventional war, which we're doing. So we don't really need to talk about this, and it's not helpful. And I agree with Putin on that.
Well, what do the Brits say about having a war with the Russians? Because it's certainly, from what Andrew Bridgen was saying a few weeks ago, apparently they think they're already at war with Russians, and Rishi Sunak doesn't want to be a war prime minister, which is one of the reasons he's called a general election. Starmer and Mandelson and Blair and Campbell are all ready to fight a war. In fact, they rather like it, many people think, as a way of diverting attention away from potential failures at home and inability to deal with the completely broken economy. So we've kind of got despotic leaders already, but even more despotic ones potentially about to take over the country. So let's have a listen to Sir Patrick Sanders, one of the army chiefs here in the UK, apparently breaking protocol to warn about a possible full-scale world war. Are the Brits really ready to fight it?
You've been speaking to General Sir Patrick Sanders, of course. Now, he's not shy with his words, we should point that out, but he did want to urge, he did want to send out a clear message today to you.
Yes, as you say, he is quite well known for his frankness, and I think for that reason the MOD did want to try and keep him away from speaking to me, but I did manage to grab him. And I did ask him a couple of questions, and one of those was, you know, obviously referencing D-Day and whether we could face something similar to, you know, the scale of the Second World War again in the future, and to which he responded, Yes, basically. He said that, yeah, it felt like ancient history to young people, the Second World War. However, warfare on that scale could happen again. But he said to deter such such events, he said that we need to have a credible and strong armed forces. He did infer that actually, you know, he had to make do with what he's got. He's got an army that is shrinking. It's shrunk by 10,000 troops over the last few years. And he made clear that there was more to do to make sure that the army that he was given is more prepared for a future conflict of that scale. Mm. So quite controversial comments. I think that people in the MOD will be listening to what he said, and they'll probably be a bit annoyed by the fact he's been so candid with us.
Well, I don't think he's saying anything particularly surprising, is he, Martin, that we're not ready for a major war, but that one like World War II might be coming soon?
Yeah, but of course the reason he's saying that is because he's got a retirement plan, which is to be on the board of various companies, which will then supply the weaponry to the armed forces as a result of, you know, this warmongering attitude. I think he's quite right that we're not prepared, and the reality is we will never be prepared to take on Russia. They are much too strong for us. We wouldn't try and fight with the United States of America for the same reason.
Well, what about the retired British, and this is a Rear Admiral, a guy called Dr. Chris Parry. What does he think? Is NATO prepared for war?
I think the idea of national service is good. National service across the board. I think there's a great ability, like all sorts of other schemes, for young people to give them additional skills. But let's be certain, with regard to the armed forces, unless it adds to the fighting capability of the armed forces, you're wasting their time. It's as simple as that. It just becomes a means rather than an end again. You know, and what are we trying to achieve here? You know, throughout my career, I've seen the armed forces as a fantastic social mobility engine. I've seen people taken from sinker states and the most abusive backgrounds and turned into the most amazing achieving adults. It's good for that. But that's not its primary role. No. Its primary role is to deter the king's enemies and to defeat them. Anything that detracts from that, I'm afraid, will weaken our armed forces. You know, we're not going to be childminders in the future. We need to be able to fight. As I said, the nation's enemies. Excuse me.
So we can't defend ourselves. We don't spend enough.
We can defend ourselves because we're in NATO and we've got the United States.
Okay. Can Europe defend itself on its own?
Mm-mm.
No.
Against whom?
Russia.
No.
Okay.
China.
No. And when Russia... If Russia decides it wants to fire the same missiles that it's fired... against Ukraine at Western Europe, we've got no defences to deal with that.
So what he's saying there is really, Martin, that the only defence we've got is the United States, big umbrella of the big boys across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and of course you've got these Russian ships in Cuba now, which is basically the reason they are there, is that if the United States decided to send troops to Europe, they'd have to put them on ships in the east coast of the United States, and then it would be sunk on the way to Europe. They'd never get there. That's an obvious thing that the Russians are going to do. You know, he's right there about, you know, national service is not the answer to this, because it's you don't need a load of people that can't. I mean, they've got conscription in Ukraine, but the kind of people they're conscripting have got no hope whatever of being able to use complex equipment like Storm Shadow missiles.
That's former Rear Admiral Chris Parry. At this point, I'd just like to introduce a document which we've discussed on this show before. I was quite worried to see, I don't know if you've been on there recently, Martin, that the Saker website has just vanished, basically.
He decided that he didn't want to carry on doing it.
Well, no, but at least he could have kept his website up there. It's gone. I mean, I'm looking for it. I think it's been blocked or something.
No, he basically...
Let's look for it now, if I can.
What he said, Andre, who runs the website, because he's Russian origin... And he lives in the United States, that once real conflict happened between the two sides, he was going to go silent. He said he was going to do that, and that's what he's done.
A lot of the people
who used to be on it,
it is there,
but it's blocked. There's nothing new on it.
Right. So it's okay? Just a sort of archive. It's called
it's an archive, yeah.
The Saker, the Thesaker Dot SI. He's a former military advisor to the United Nations, and one of the most interesting documents that he posted on there, this is back in 2019 February, is something called the alternative Skripal narrative. Now this is, we have been told that some FSB agents came to Salisbury, to the UK, to poison and kill Sergei Skripal, former FSB officer, I think he was, wasn't he, and his daughter, and but they failed, and then they escaped and they ran away. So what was, I mean, this is supposed to be the British doing a fantastic job, MI6, etc., in exposing a secret Russian plot.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously we covered this at the time, and I was actually on RT at the time, because RT was still a thing in Britain, and we were discussing all the ins and outs of this. I think with hindsight, it's pretty clear that the whole of this operation was an MI6 operation, part of Operation Beluga, which has been run by NATO for many years, which is designed to make the public fear the Russians and see them as an enemy. And if you think about when this Skripal attack happened, it was when the Russians were just about to host the World Cup in Russia. And therefore they're trying to use their soft power. The whole world's coming to Russia to play football. And of course, somebody evil, Putin, said, and we'll use this opportunity to go and try and kill.
But it's
this
one of the main things that
keeps Salisbury.
Yeah, it keeps
doesn't
getting
make
trotted,
sense,
trotted out as a reason. Oh, the Russians are after us. You know, we need on. They're so evil, and etc. But there are some terrific sections in this, and it's. And what I will do is I'll share it in the weekly newsletter this week that I send out for listeners. So if you want to subscribe during or in the next few days, email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, or if you can't remember that, just go to thisweek.org.uk and you'll find my email address there, and I'll make sure you get a copy of this, because it's fast. I just printed a copy of it out today. It's a 20-page document. You can print it out double side, just 10 pages as I've got here, and it just takes you through the alternative narrative of what actually happened in Salisbury. I felt really annoyed about that whole operation, and well, the news story, the PSYOP, having been a reporter for nearly a year for the BBC in Salisbury and really having no opportunity to get my voice heard apart from on this show, did some phone-ins and things like that, didn't get through, and I've done a few podcasts about it, one which did very well, but there were so many holes in this story. I mean, God knows why it didn't just sink at the first effort, but there's so many people out there in the press who just want, they don't want to question things. I mean, one paragraph from the alternative narrative from the narrative from the Saker site is, it says, the thing that proves this was a British crime and not a Russian crime is the fact that Yulia was a prime target. The Russians had no motive whatsoever to eliminate her, but if they had, they could have done it in Russia with a simple road accident with no questions asked. Only the British had to do it in Britain, since they didn't have the resources in place to do it in Russia. And if she was not a prime target but collateral damage, why was Sergei not attacked when he was alone? Why wait for her to visit him? The fact they were both targeted the day after she arrived in Britain puts MI6's signature all over this. She was a danger to MI6 because she knew of Sergei's plan to return to Russia and trash the Steele dossier, and she had to be stopped from revealing this to the world when he was killed. Silencing her at the same time was just as important to MI6 as silencing him. So, interesting, just one paragraph in this enormous, well, it's not that enormous, and you're very welcome, listeners, to a copy of that to print out and just peruse at your own leisure of the obvious facts that haven't been asked by any, it seems to me, British journalists who are part of this, even though they may well not realise it, Operation Beluga, in order to just smear Russia, part of the Russophobic campaign to start World War III.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of what's been, I mean, the shoot down of the MH17 aircraft in Ukraine. We got eyewitnesses.
Which Case van der Peil, by the way, has done a book on that.
Yes, yes. We got eyewitnesses on the ground.
And the Malaysians.
Spoke to BBC Russia.
The Malaysians were shut out of the entire inquiry.
Yes, exactly. So, in other words, these things which are presented to us as the evil crimes of the deep state in Russia are in fact the evil crimes of the deep state in the West as part of a campaign to start a war with Russia, which they've managed to succeed in doing. Don't forget, when Skripal was murdered or perhaps whisked away to Bali, the Russians were at the still at the stage of trying to make friends. You know, we're hosting the World Cup. We want everybody to come here. We just want to be a normal
Someone,
country.
Someone somewhere had already decided to get it started, hadn't they?
Well, that's right. They did. They weren't. They were determined not to make peace with Russia. And Putin, of course, because he's been around for such a long time, in the early stages of his career, was regarded as a pro-Western politician in Russia. He was regarded as somebody who wanted to do deals with the West, and, you know, we've got to be realistic and pragmatic about dealing with
it.
But he's changed his mind for obvious reasons.
The latest on Ukraine, the latest escalations by the West. Today, Biden and Zelensky have signed a 10-year bilateral military deal. Imagine part of this is this $50 billion of Russian assets that they're using over 10 years to make sure that this war keeps going and the meat grinder carries on.
Yeah, but I think what's going to happen at a certain point with this meat grinder is that at a certain point, and it's probably going to be quite soon, because or possibly next year, because if the Russians don't push their advantage before the autumn, they're going to be stuck, because it's the way war in Ukraine has always been.
Oh, and also
it's all mud and you can't go anywhere.
Today, Jens Stoltenberg from Bilderberg and from NATO and from everything super far right fascist and Nazi is saying Ukraine using F-16s on Russia won't be an escalation. Well, the Russians don't agree, do they? And why is that?
Well, exactly. So they can say, we're going to allow the Ukrainians to fly these. The F-16s have to be flown from proper airfields, and the Ukrainian airfields have been degraded. So they can't be used like Russian kit can be used from just random bits of road. So they'll have to be flown in from outside Ukraine.
Poland?
Yeah, from Poland or Romania or wherever. And, of course, at that point, their bases in Poland or Romania or wherever become a legitimate target for the Russian military.
Well, the Russians have spelled this out, haven't they? If you start thinking about using these F-16s, those bases in Poland are going to be hit.
That's right. And
Does that mean World War III?
Well, we're already in World War III. The question is it going to be a nuclear annihilation? You know, that's the main
thing. Is it just
issue.
Another? It's a ratchet, isn't it? We've got a ratchet going here. Click, 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 click. Every click, we're getting closer to a
nuclear
war.
That's right. And, of course, the problem with it, just like in 1962 and the
King
Cuban
Charles
missile crisis.
Has got to say about all this, our head of state. What have you got to say about all this, King Charles? Are you going click, click, click and rubbing your hands? Or are you trying to, save everybody in this country?
Well, I mean, I don't think we really want. I mean, King Charles is a numpty. He's nothing really to do with any of it, in my view.
No, he's a Putin is the new Hitler.
That just shows what a numpty he is, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but numpties can drag you into World War III.
That's right, that's
a
right.
A lot of people would say that many of the advisers and even Hitler himself was a numpty.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one of the right-wing...
You seem to be trying to excuse the head of state.
Well,
it's not really his fault.
No, it's Patrick Sanders, who we heard earlier, who's the head of the British Army. Mm. He's the one who should be standing. He shouldn't be saying any of that. In actual fact, it's not his place to decide whether we go to war with Russia or not.
Yeah, but maybe he'd lose his job.
He's supposed to do as he's told.
He'd lose his job. Would he lose favour with the American deep state if he wasn't saying these things?
Well, indeed,
but
he's supposed to be leading the British Army, and he's supposed to be answerable to us. And in actual fact, he's not supposed to be making comments about war and peace
NATO's,
like that at all.
NATO's top
he's supposed
military,
to just keep his mouth shut.
NATO's top military officer, however, will round up with, having listened to him, Rob Bauer is talking about a potential war in Ukraine expanding. He's talking about also here about European security and the world order. So let's have a listen to what the NATO's top military. We've been listening to what the British officers are saying, serving and retired. Now, what about one of the actual NATO chiefs, Rob Bauer?
President Biden just last month joined the recommendation of NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg and other European leaders in authorizing Ukraine to use U.S. weapons to strike inside Russia. This was described as limited strikes in terms of range. Make the case for our listeners, if you would, as to why U.S. and NATO weapons should be attacking Russia directly, and how do you evaluate the risks in making that decision?
Well, I would turn it around. Militarily, it is the best thing to do. If you are attacked from a nation that is illegally attacking you and they start a war and you are defending yourself, you can do two things. You can wait until the missiles reach you and then try to kill the arrows, or you kill the archer. And the archer is, in many ways, in Russia. There's aircraft taking off from airfields in Russia. There's the logistic support for the fight in Ukraine from the Russians, which is oil and gas, which is logistics, which is transportation, which is the production of weapons, which is all the things you need in a war. They are being produced and being brought from Russia. So it is the logic thing to do militarily, and it is possible within the law of armed conflict to do that, because the Russians started this war and the Ukrainians are defending themselves. So it is militarily logic. It is within the law possible to do it. And the only discussion for a while between some nations that gave longer range weapon systems to Ukraine and Ukraine has been whether they would allow Ukraine to do that. And I'm happy for Ukraine that that permission is there.
And do you think, Admiral, that there should be limits on the range of those weapons? How far into Russia do you think they should strike, or do you think that should be left to the Ukrainians?
Again, there is in the law on armed conflicts, there's no limits in terms of the range. So militarily, again, if the target is deeper into Russia, then militarily you want to strike that target. If for example, the aircraft that take off from an airfield deeper into Russia. What we've seen with the increasing range that the Ukrainians have been given to strike was that the Russians had to push back, to bring back their logistic nodes. And that, of course, makes it more difficult for the Russians to be successful in the fight. If you have to bring back your logistics from, let's say, 10, 15, 20 kilometers to 50, 100 kilometers, that will make it more cumbersome for the Russians to bring in the logistics. And that helps in the fight. So I think that is the thing you want to do. And if the Russians have to be, if you push back the Russians deeper into Russia, that will make the fight more difficult for them. So and again, this discussion on escalation, we've heard many times that Putin used, or other officials used, the word red lines when it came to the tanks, when it came to the HIMARS, when it came to the ATACMS. And every time we sort of waited a little bit longer to think about it, and then we gave it. And the result was actually that it wasn't a red line, but the actual result was that the Russians were able to strengthen their defensive works in Ukraine. So in many ways, we have allowed Putin to work on his defense based on him saying it was a red line. And every time we gave the weapon and we used it against him, he's not stupid, so he understands it's within the law and it is militarily logic, then it wasn't a red line. So we have to be careful not to jump time and time again to this idea that everything is a red line, that everything is an escalation, because first and foremost, Putin has been lying about basically everything. He recently said he would never attack a NATO country. He said to the reporters, "If you think that, you are stupid." Well, he lied about attacking Ukraine. So I think the time is over that we should allow Putin to self-deter us, because that's basically what has happened many, many times.
No, indeed. Ukraine is not a NATO country, but he's making the point. Bob Bauer there, he's Dutch, he's an admiral, and he's chair of NATO's military committee. What he's saying is that, well, Putin lied once, he might well lie again, Martin. He might attack a NATO country.
Well, I think they haven't ruled it out.
They've actually said, haven't they, now, that if you start flying these F-16s out of Poland, we're going to attack Poland.
Yeah.
Which the reason why is because they are nuclear capable. They can carry standoff nuclear weapons, F-16s.
Right. So in other words, what may happen here is we end up with a nuclear war, because if the F-16 flies and they think it's nuclear armed, they might decide to go to, you know, to nuclear war straight away.
Yeah, but the Russians
away.
Might be wrong. It might not be nuclear armed.
Yeah, but can they afford to take the risk? It's stupid to make them think like.
Anyway, this is a.
I mean there's been attacks on these early warning systems by the Ukrainians. Now this is very provocative to the Russians, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in the old days of the BBC, if I might say, and maybe in the 1970s or 80s, I can imagine there being, you know, quite highbrow discussions in the evening, a discussion program, even a documentary looking into the possibility of nuclear war now and looking at all sides. Maybe having a bit of a bias, but there's none of that at all. And this is why we've had... there's nothing. I mean, no explanation, really. No, as we're kind of sleepwalking towards this potential nuclear conflict, no real examination of it. And so there was actually this week a emergency press conference organised by Scott Ritter and various other characters. They are... Let's just look. It's... Colonel Richard Black, Ray McGovern, former CIA, and this woman, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who's the originator and the founder of the Schiller Institute. And they entitled their press conference, Emergency Press Conference, The Danger of Nuclear War is Real and Must Be Stopped. Scott Ritter introduced it.
Here today to talk to you about a topic that sadly is being ignored. Pick up the morning newspaper, pick up the afternoon newspaper, pick up any newspaper, and I doubt you're going to see on the headline, America at imminent risk of nuclear Armageddon. But that should be the headline of every newspaper. That should be the lead story of every newscast. Not because the goal is to frighten people. I've had many people accuse me of fear-mongering, saying that it's irresponsible what you're doing promoting fear. I say it's irresponsible for the American public, for the American citizen, to allow the government that works for them to engage in policies that will lead to the termination of all human life on the planet Earth as we know it. And that's the end result here. We're talking about a number of things. Today we can talk about a failure of diplomacy. You know, I have said that we are at a period of time in our nation's history that is far more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And a lot of people take umbrage at that, especially people who didn't live during the Cuban Missile Crisis and have no concept of what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. But the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, people have said that's the closest the United States and the Soviet Union came to nuclear war. In a way, they're right. But let me talk about some differences at that time. While the Soviets were sending ships with missiles to Cuba, the danger was they were going to run into a blockade, lead to a direct military conflict that could expand into a nuclear conflict. While all that was happening, a man named John McCloy was speaking to a man named Valerian Zorin. Diplomacy was taking place. The United States were actively engaging with the Soviet counterparts to prevent the very war everybody was afraid of. The reason why there was no war is because there was diplomacy. Because leaders were talking to leaders. If not directly, then indirectly. If not through official channels, then through the back channel. Diplomacy was alive and well. Today, ladies and gentlemen, right down the road in Wisconsin Avenue is an embassy, the Russian embassy. Seated in that embassy is a diplomat named Anatoly Antonov, one of the most distinguished American experts in the Russian Foreign Service, the lead arms control negotiator for the last remaining arms control treaty between Russia and the United States. He's been sitting there for several years, and his phone is not ringing. We are not calling him. We are not talking to him. There is no diplomacy today. And yet, our two countries are on a collision course that could very well lead to a nuclear conflict. And when I say nuclear conflict, let's be clear here. Now we're going to talk about doctrine. You know, there was a time when nuclear weapons existed for the purpose of deterring nuclear attack. Now, it's a sick thing, to, you know, this concept of deterrence, mutually assured destruction, is sort of insanity encapsulated into, you know, a couple words. But that's the reality of it. The United States had nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, and we had to make sure that nobody felt confident enough to use these weapons preemptively to gain some sort of strategic advantage. The end result was mutually assured destruction, nuclear deterrence. And this worked up until the end of the Soviet Union. It worked so well, I have to say, you know, one of my first adult jobs was as a Marine Corps officer implementing arms control treaties in the former Soviet Union, part of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, where we got rid of entire categories of nuclear weapons. The first time that we didn't just limit the growth, we actually reduced the arsenals. And this could have led to even greater cuts in the nuclear arsenals. But no, not for the United States. When the Soviet Union went away, we decided that we needed to maintain a nuclear advantage over the Soviets, and we corrupted the concept of arms control. We withdrew from arms control treaties like the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which gave mutually assured destruction its teeth. See, without ballistic missile defense, the missiles will hit their target, which means that if you go to war, your missiles will hit the target they're aimed at, the missiles aimed at you will hit the target. Under George W. Bush, we decided we didn't want any missiles to hit America. Ostensibly a rational thought, except at the same time we were seeking to gain nuclear supremacy over the Russians so that our missiles would hit Russia. This creates an imbalance. And after 9/11, we went further. We saw a transition of nuclear deterrence doctrine into nuclear war fighting doctrine, where we embraced a doctrine that said that we could use nuclear weapons preemptively against a non-nuclear threat. Our current president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, Joe Biden, campaigned on a promise to return America to the sanity of sole use doctrine, meaning the sole purpose of America's nuclear arsenal would be to deter others from attacking us. He didn't do it. Why? I attended a reunion of intermediate nuclear forces, inspectors, negotiators a couple years ago, and we asked that question to a senior Biden administration arms control official. The answer, the interagency isn't ready for this yet. Now, I live in a nation that is ostensibly the greatest democracy in the world. I know that I go to vote. I know I look at the names on the ballot. I never saw interagency on the ballot. I don't know what the hell they're talking about when it comes to democracy. The president is the commander-in-chief. He is the executive. If he wants a policy direction, he directs it to happen. And the interagency needs to salute smartly and seek to implement it. But we're being told that the interagency isn't ready. That means the establishment isn't ready. That means the establishment seeks something else. And that, of course, is American nuclear supremacy. We live in a world where other nations will no longer tolerate this. Russia is one of them. And Russia today is a nation that is at the pointy end of the American nuclear spear. They're seeing the United States promulgate policies that have American military capabilities thrust up to the very borders of Russia, indeed crossing over into the borders of Russia, threatening Russia's strategic nuclear enterprise, early warning radars, command and control facilities, even nuclear weapons depots and nuclear launch systems. We have facilitated, we being the United States, an attack against Ingalls Air Base where Russian strategic nuclear bombers are stationed. Under Russian doctrine, this alone justifies a nuclear response. We've been tickling the Russian nuclear bear for a long time, and only through the patience and wisdom of the Russian leadership have we avoided a nuclear war. As an American, I take umbrage at that. I don't want to be at the mercy of any foreign leader. I would rather that the American leadership take a rational step towards deconfliction, that I be at the mercy of a government that I get to hold accountable at the polls, government of the people, by the people, for the people, a constitution that begins with we the people of the United States of America. And that's the final thought I want to put out there. We have a duty and responsibility as citizens to wake up and recognize the threats that face us collectively as a nation, as a people. And the greatest threat to the continued survival of the United States of America today is American nuclear policy, American nuclear weapons. These weapons do not protect us, ladies and gentlemen. These weapons are literally a loaded gun at our head with an insane man's finger on the trigger. We need to come together. We need to stop this. We have an election in November, and let us all do our job as citizens and vote for somebody who places the survival of America above all else, which means they place nuclear nonproliferation, nuclear disarmament, and arms control above all else. Thank you very much.
So that's a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and weapons inspector, as well as negotiator for arms talks, Scott Ritter, opening that press conference with various others speaking after. I'll put the full version of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from the Schiller Institute. So that's also with Colonel Richard Black, Ray McGovern, and this lady called Helga Zepp LaRouche. So, I mean, it's a pretty strident speech he's giving there, Martin, but he's saying effectively that there is a conspiracy within the United States to actually start a nuclear war, and that their policy and their doctrine is hell-bent on doing it.
Well, I can understand why he's getting worked up there. I mean, I get worked up, and I haven't had anything like the direct experience he's had of
no
what's
coverage
going on.
Whatsoever of this emergency press conference. Yeah. I mean, it's like the ostriches sticking their head in the sand. There's no worry about nuclear war anyway if it happens. Maybe it's just inevitable. There is a rather dark side to all of this, is that if there is some sort of nuclear exchange, the idea is that maybe conventional exchange, the idea is the populace will be made to think, oh, this is just the Russians, this is coming out of nowhere, those evil Russians.
Well, if they're all dead, they won't be thinking anything, which is the danger. You know, we heard Putin earlier saying, and God forbid that it should come to this. We shouldn't be discussing this, because it should be obvious that nobody should be using nuclear weapons or even threatening to use nuclear weapons. Why have we ripped up all the arms control treaties that were made with the Russians? Why have we ripped them up? It wasn't the Russians who ripped them up, we ripped them up. And then we say, well, we don't want war, but we don't want any of these treaties with you, because we might be able to, you know, to get you. You know, the treaties were there to protect everybody from a nuclear war. Well, and we've ripped them all up.
In the meantime,
everybody in Russia knows this, but I bet you loads of people in Britain don't even know we've ripped up all these treaties.
In the meantime, the Russian Navy, a naval fleet, has been chugging its way over, and it's now arrived in Havana, Cuba.
Firing a 21-gun salvo as it came into Havana Bay. A Russian naval flotilla docked on the island for the first time since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. En route, a Russian frigate fired artillery in drills. The Biden administration said the deployment was notable, but not dangerous.
Great. We, of course, take it seriously, but these exercises don't pose a threat to the United States.
Nonetheless, it deployed three destroyers to track the Russian deployment. Some Cubans watching the ships pull in felt it was poignant. 5 years ago, U.S. cruise ships docked in this bay, and American tourists pumped money into the island's economy. They were banned by the Trump administration, which allowed the cruise liners to be sued for hundreds of millions of dollars for docking here.
It's hard to imagine a more powerful image of how far U.S.-Cuban relations have been bulldozed over the last 5 years. A Russian nuclear-powered submarine docked right where U.S. cruise liners no longer can.
Analysts say hardened U.S. sanctions and economic desperation are pushing Havana closer to Moscow.
This is something that Cuba had forgotten, that connection. And it has come back to that connection because there's no other choice. And there's no other choice directly because of United States sanctions and what can only be called sustained economic warfare against Cuba. And desperate diseases require desperate remedies.
And the number of Russian tourists for the first 3 months of this year doubled compared to this time last year. And 90,000 tons of Russian oil arrived this March following protests against food and power shortages in Santiago, Cuba's second city. Meanwhile, Cuba's position on the war in Ukraine has transformed over the last 2 years. From one that stressed the importance of respecting international law to one that is strongly pro-Russian.
Both nations, Russia and Cuba, are imposed with unjust sanctions that have the origin in the same enemy, the Yankee Empire.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and potent sanctions are drawing new geopolitical fault lines and are rekindling friendships of old. Ed Augustin, Al Jazeera, Havana.
Yes, it seems obvious to me that this arrival of this fleet, which is the frigate called the Admiral Gorshkov, nuclear-powered submarine Kazan, accompanied by a tugboat and a fuel ship, arriving in Cuba. The way it should be obvious to everyone, this is a little reminder of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a military manoeuvre. It's more of a sort of political signalling. Because, of course, if you're going to say you can bring your missiles into Ukraine, which you're going to fire into our country, the obvious thing we're going to say is we're going to fire back into your country, United States of America. You may be 10,000 miles away, but this is the modern world. We can hit your bases inside the US. You hit a military base inside Russia and kill some of our guys. We're going to hit a military base in Louisiana and kill some of your guys. And we'll go up the escalation ladder from there. Let's start off with 10, 20, 30 dead on each side, and we can make it up to hundreds of thousands of dead on each side if that's where you want to go.
While they were still off the coast, the four Russian vessels conducted high-precision missile weapon training in the Atlantic. Whilst on their way to Cuba, the submarine and frigate are equipped with Zircon hypersonic missiles, the Kalibr cruise missiles and Onyx anti-ship missiles, the Russian Ministry of Defense has revealed. So, but the Americans are saying, oh, there's nothing to see here, really. It's nothing dangerous, kind of normal, really.
Well, I mean, in one way, it's just a freedom of navigation operation, which is what the Royal Navy carries out in the South China Sea. You know, the sea is open to anybody. The Russians can sail anywhere. In 1905, they sailed all the way from what was then St. Petersburg and is now St. Petersburg, all the way round to Tsushima Strait in Japan. All the way round. And then nobody stopped them because the high seas are open to everybody. So in a sense, there's no reason why the Russians can't, that, you know, but I mean, it's a reminder to the American public, the US public. They really do think this is all happening a long way away from them. And maybe to see a Russian nuclear submarine armed with all of everything that it's armed with just cruising around off the coast of Florida is just a reminder. Now, if you want to send your weapons to Ukraine, we're in your backyard as well. And, you know, you hit our bases, we're going to hit your bases. I mean, that's basically what the Russians have been saying.
Guterres, the UN Secretary General this week, moving on, has been talking about Gaza particularly. And it's interesting the UN is blasting from the top of its voice. I've been seeing very little or nothing about this on the mainstream press this week. Obviously, I'm not watching and listening to every single bulletin. But they're saying, look, you know, the Israelis have now stopped any aid getting in. People are bound to slowly die. The only aid that's now in Gaza is stuff that's been stockpiled from previous weeks. So this is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres this week.
It's now 8 months since the horrific Hamas terror attacks on 7 October and the abduction of Israeli men, women and children to Gaza. But 8 months of relentless suffering for Palestinian civilians in Gaza. The speed and scale of the carnage and killing in Gaza is beyond anything in my years as Secretary General. At least 1.7 million people, 75% of Gaza's population, have been displaced many times over by Israel military attacks. Nowhere is safe. Conditions are deplorable. The public health situation is beyond crisis level. Gaza's hospitals lie in ruins. Medical supplies and fuel are scarce or non-existent. More than 1 million Palestinians in Gaza do not have enough clean drinking water and face desperate levels of hunger. Over 50,000 children require treatment for acute malnutrition. And despite the ocean of needs, at least half of all humanitarian aid missions are denied access, impeded, or cancelled due to operational or security reasons. On top of all these, since the attack on the Rafah border crossing 1 month ago, the flow of critical humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza, which was already woefully inadequate, has plummeted by two-thirds. Excellencies, in the face of this calamity, the world has tried its best to save lives. And I want to express my gratitude to Egypt and Jordan for all their efforts. Your Majesty, through you, allow me to thank the people of Jordan for the relief provided, including through aid convoys, airdrops, and field hospitals. We all appreciate immensely your personal commitment to mobilize the international community and your persistent call for a robust coordination mechanism for the unimpeded and safe flow of sufficient aid to the people of Gaza. I urge the international community to support Jordan's efforts as it undertakes its critical role assisting the people of Gaza and serving as a key regional humanitarian hub.
So that's the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Martin. I mean, the whole situation in Gaza, obviously horrific, going on and on and on. One does wonder if this is being kept deliberately on the back burner so that when it really kicks off in Ukraine, that no one will kind of notice it and it will just become part of the same wider war. But it is being talked about as a war between the Palestinians and Israel. But really, it's not, is it? Because the Israelis don't have the ability to really hit back at Israel. It's much more of a massacre by the United States and Britain and the EU and Israel on Palestine and Palestinians.
Well, you misspoke there and said the Israelis, it's the Palestinians that can't really hit back. Although, in fact, they can. They are. The Hamas.
They can really only hit back against the IDF actually in Gaza. Can't
that's
they?
Right. But nevertheless, they have not been. The point about the kind of war that Hamas is fighting, they've got no mountains to retreat into, they've got no jungles to retreat into, but they're in their tunnels. And those
but they're not fighting a guerrilla war in Tel Aviv, are they?
Well, Hezbollah are going to sort that out in the next week or so.
You reckon?
Oh, yeah. That's where we're going with this.
Why do you say that? Come on.
Because the Israeli right wing want to attack Lebanon. It's insane. They will lose that war. But Hezbollah have got a lot more kit than Hamas.
So what do you make loads of Benny Gantz's resignation?
He is basically positioning himself to replace Netanyahu when the war is lost.
Oh. Yeah, maybe.
Because they're going to lose it.
And it just seemed to me very much. I mean, it's like it's for someone that experienced a bit of the troubles, Northern Ireland troubles, when you actually see it up close, you can see one side is belligerent, the other side is, which were the nationalists at the time in Belfast, particularly in Belfast, wandering around Belfast, you probably saw it yourself. One side is pushing the conflict, the other side wants peace. I think it's exactly the same in over in Israel and Palestine, that the Israelis want war and the Palestinians want peace, but they're not going to get it because the Israelis are not going to let them have it.
Well, I mean, if you look at all the shenanigans that have gone on around this latest peace proposal, which has gone through the UN Security Council, and the US administration, Blinken and so on, have been saying the objections to this are from Hamas, and Hamas says, well, there's no objection. We've just got to have guarantees for what we've already signed up for. But the Israelis have made it absolutely clear that they are not signing anything until they've completely defeated Hamas. Now, that means you can't negotiate with people that you insist you've got to completely defeat them before you're going to have a discussion
with
them.
Yeah, and the United it's Nations have been firing on all cylinders this week with our good old Tedros, I never pronounce his surname, the head of the World Health Organization, is also saying, hey, guys, Gaza is dying. There's a horrific health crisis in Gaza. So let's have a listen to him now this week.
To Gaza. WHO welcomes the UN Security Council resolution adopted on Monday, which calls for a full and immediate ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, a permanent end to hostilities, and the reconstruction of Gaza. We urge all parties to take steps to implement the resolution immediately and bring a permanent end to the suffering of millions of people. We also welcome this week's conference in Amman, Jordan, which aims to intensify humanitarian aid for Gaza. A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. Despite reports of increased delivery of food, there is currently no evidence that those who need it most are receiving sufficient quantity and quality of food. WHO and our partners have scaled up nutrition services. Over 8,000 children under 5 years old have been diagnosed and treated for acute malnutrition, including 1,600 children with severe acute malnutrition. However, due to insecurity and lack of access, only 2 stabilization centers for severely malnourished patients can operate. Our inability to provide health services safely, combined with the lack of clean water and sanitation, significantly increased the risks of malnourished children.
So that's Tedros, impossible to pronounce surname, from the World Health Organization, Martin. I mean, this is, there's no health service, no education, very little aid, if any, getting in, 8,000 kids malnourished, they're getting thinner and thinner. I don't know if you've been seeing the pictures. I mean, it's like Belsen.
It is. It's horrific. And the only shred of anything that I can say to try and, you know, mitigate this in some way is that Israel is losing the war. They are. They're killing loads and loads of civilians, and that's their goal. But they haven't defeated Hamas. They haven't defeated Hezbollah. They haven't defeated Iran. They haven't defeated the Syrian Arab Army or the Russian army that's based in Syria. And ultimately, of course, probably what's going to have to happen here is we are going to have a World War III. But at the end of World War III, there will be no Israeli state.
It seems to be the flavour from the beginning of part two from the Russian forum is the Russians are prepared to fight World War. They're obviously very reluctant. They're prepared to fight World War III, and they think that they can win. You know, they think that they can actually subdue their enemies, whereas it doesn't seem to me as if our lot think the same, that they seem to just almost want to bang their head against a brick wall that is Russia.
Well, not just to bang their head, they want to bang their head against the people of Yemen. They want to bang their head against the Iranians. They want to bang their head against, I don't know, the Colombians, possibly. They're basically belligerent. I mean, of course, the image in the West is that we are basically benign, and there are all these evil people out there who are trying to, you know, stop us doing good things. But that's not how the rest of the world sees it.
Yeah,
at
it seems
all,
like this obvious reasons. This Netanyahu mentality is like a virus which has spread right throughout the Zionist Western elite, where they think that we are a bunch of crims, we're in a little club, we'll protect each other, and when our judicial system or any of our police or any of our citizens try and rise up and sort things out, then we can just press the nuclear button and we can send them all to kingdom come.
Well, this is the problem, is that it's not entirely rational. Somebody like Netanyahu would probably press the nuclear button without a second thought. It's quite clear. He's that sort of person. Of course, you know, the Israeli politician that called for nuking Gaza is just a numpty, because you can't nuke Gaza without nuking Israel at the same time. Iran? Definitely
why
possible.
Why do we support the Israelis? I cannot understand this. I'll let you answer after we hear from the lovely Annie Masham, former NI5 officer, talking about a little shindig in London back in 1994 with the Israeli Mossad.
A full flag attack in London in 1994, where a car bomb exploded outside the Israeli embassy. The senior MI5 officer, who was in charge of the investigation into it, and had seen all the evidence but also all the intelligence, which isn't necessarily admissible in court, wrote his formal assessment at the end of the case, and he said he reckoned that Mossad, the Israeli external intelligence agency, had bombed their own embassy. And he said that they did it for two reasons. One, they were always hassling MI5 for increased security around their embassy and other interests in London, because, of course, London had a reputation of giving safe haven to Arab dissidents from around the world at that point. And MI5 kept saying, well, there's no reason to increase the threat assessment. You don't need extra protection. So letting off a controlled explosion outside, of course, they immediately got what they wanted there. But crucially, two innocent Palestinians were arrested, charged and convicted of conspiracy to cause that attack. And they were very active in a Palestinian support network in London, political campaigning for the people on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And they were gaining some traction in the media. They were getting quite a lot of support. So by arresting these people and framing them from the attack and sticking them in prison, the whole network just shattered and hasn't got back on its feet to this day. So that would be a clear political advantage for Mossad to have achieved in London by framing these innocent people for an attack which was carried out by Mossad.
And it seems that that sort of attack by the Mossad that she's describing there Annie, fantastic whistleblower in the 1990s, former MI5 officer speaking. She's explaining that they have such chutzpah and cheek that they can just blow a bomb up in London, blame it on whoever they want for their own political ends. And our own security services, our own domestic intelligence services will do absolutely nothing, nor special branch, nor the Met Police about it.
Not only that, but they were these two innocent people were convicted under British law, presumably arrested by British police officers, even though the evidence shows that it should be the Mossad officers who should stand trial for planting that bomb. And of course, the other thing that people fail to understand about the Israelis and NATO intelligence services as well, they're quite prepared to kill people, their own people, who are not on the inside, to make other people look bad. It's very hard for ordinary people to understand the kind of mentality that they have. Because, so that when they invaded Lebanon in the 80s, that happened because there was an attack on an Israeli diplomat in Britain, which again was orchestrated by them. In Moscow, for example, the attempts to, the assassination of Boris Nemtsov, pretty clearly to me, it was carried out by the West in order to discredit Putin, even though Nemtsov was a pro-Western politician. And they're quite prepared to sacrifice people who are not in the know in order to make their point.
So that
and
bomb,
they've done
that
it
bomb,
loads of times.
That bomb was on the 26th of July 1994 against the Israeli embassy building. 20 civilians were injured. And later that same day, a second bomb, or the next day, was exploded outside Balfour House in Finchley, the premises occupied by a Jewish organisation. So just looking at who was convicted, Samar Alami, a Lebanese Palestinian woman and daughter of a banker, graduated with a BSc in chemical engineering from University College London, and an MSc from Imperial College, and also Jawad Botma, a Palestinian student based in London, graduated with a degree in electronic engineering from the University of Leicester and King's College London. But actually, were they really the bombers at all, even though they were convicted of conspiracy to cause explosions? She says no, and she's on the inside.
Well, she's right. And of course, what people don't understand is that Mossad are quite capable of... they even boast about how devious they are.
So I suppose the idea is here...
They have this mentality that they can just manipulate everything doing these kind of stunts.
Well, they did. And in this particular case, I suppose you're looking at any kind of political or campaign or organisation, maybe even a political party. Maybe someone could explode a bomb, blame it on George Galloway and put him away.
Well, this has been going on in the Irish war, Tony. Lots of this stuff has happened. Yeah, so it's not even it's just the Israelis who do these things.
Anyway,
in actual fact, it's the stock in trade of all of these people.
We like talking about these things, and so do many other people, and sharing them on social media. We're going to start winding down now with an interview I did earlier this week with Natalie Minnis, who's up in Scotland, and she does a lot of hill walking. She leads walks up there. She's been a great contributor over the years on and off to this programme, and particularly her research into the nuclear connections during the Second World War of the German nuclear program of Klaus Schwab's father. Thanks ever so much for doing that in Italy particularly. Very good bit of research, and also a former journalist. But she spoke to me this week about how she's been locked out of her Facebook account.
I've had this account on Facebook since 2009, and I have this phone which is de-Googled, so that's another issue. I have been trying to do a kind of digital detox for quite some time. So I have this phone which is called a TerraCube. It's called a Mirena TerraCube. And Mirena is a company that de-Googles it, and they're based in France. They take various phones and they will offer to de-Google them, and, you know, you pay for the phone. So they do it with the the Fairphone. And I chose this TerraCube because I particularly liked it. It's got a replaceable battery and things like that. So I bought that last year. And 7 months after I bought it, the screen went black, started going blank, and it was a display problem. And they just said, well, send it back. It's still under guarantee. But it had to be sent back to France. And as soon as the battery must have died, I lost access to Facebook and Facebook and WhatsApp. And I thought that would come back when I got the phone back. And the phone was delayed in the post. It was held up at the depot, first of all, and then it was sent back to the wrong address. It was a complete catalogue of errors. But when I finally got it back 6 weeks later, I got access to WhatsApp again, but I could not get onto Facebook. And it's just like Alice in Wonderland, because there's no particular reason. I haven't been put on the Facebook naughty step, at least I don't think so. It just keeps saying that I've got to verify it using a different device. And it wants me to verify it either with the TerraCube, but when I put it onto the TerraCube, it then says that I need to verify it with a different device or a browser. But each time I try to do that, it says, no, you need to verify it with a different device. And I even got this bizarre message saying that I was going to be blocked temporarily for going too fast.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you sent us that. I think I might share that with listeners. Yeah, for going too fast. So it was obviously thinking that you were tapping away so quickly that you must have been an AI bot.
I think that's what it was thinking. And I'm a good typist, but I'm not that good, I don't think.
No, I was thinking you're almost the opposite, really. You're fairly laid back. I wouldn't say slow, that would be rude. But, you know, you take things at your leisure. You're not rushed.
Yeah, maybe. But it's the whole thing has been crazy. And it did make me think. I had almost 400 friends on Facebook, and most of them are real friends. I will see them on, you know, through hill walking or climbing. But do I really want to be attached at the hip to Facebook? I mean, I have to say they offer you other ways to get online back on, or to get your account back. And that's either by, you know, by giving ID, either scanning your passport or your driver's license or an ID card. And I tried
That's very cheeky.
Yes. And I was on holiday last year and the same thing happened, but it was temporary. So I scanned my driver's license and I don't know what I was thinking, but I did it. I tried to scan it and it just would not accept it. And I do think this is kind of nudging us towards digital ID. I really regret the fact that I even tried to scan my driver's license, but there's no way that I'm going to use a passport or something to get onto social media. It's not a bank.
Well, good old Natalie Minnis there. I hope you get on well with you. I mean, is it all sorts of interesting things she throws up there in that little tale, Martin? One of which is just the fact that it took the phone 6 weeks to get to her. I can remember in one of these WikiLeaks massive drops of information, one of the little nuggets there was that, oh, well, the authorities, what they do is they like to, and the particularly GCHQ or NSA, what they do is they pinch your stuff which is going through the post, and then they put loads of spyware and stuff on it before it gets back to you. Well, I mean, obviously that may well have happened here. Anything you're sending through the post, I think the idea is that we cannot, you know, is bringing about this kind of zero trust society where you can't trust anyone or anything, and anyone that does steal your information, steal your stuff, whether it's, you know, stealing masses of Russian assets to give to Zelensky, these people are kleptocrats. They just think they can steal everything. But the other thing is she's trying to de-Google her phone. I mean, you know, what a laudable exercise. But then she's being told, no, you've got to scan your passport or your driving license to just get back onto your Facebook account.
Well, I try and stay away from social media. I know it's very silly of me, but I mean that's not the way I am at all.
I think you've just got to decide one way or the other.
So you know, obviously there are the general oppressions that social media puts people through. You know that we want all your information before we'll let you use this stuff.
There's a very basic thing I think with social media is you've got to decide: is it something that you want to use for your friends and family, or is it something which is? And I don't have any of my friends and family on my social media at all. I'm just using it as a way to, you know, it's media as far as I'm concerned. It's That's the right. only way to reach people. So I keep that well away. She was, Natalie also discusses, I mean, because she's an enthusiastic hill walker and she leads a lot of walks and she does rock climbing too. Laybacks, and I was in Leyburn last week, funnily enough, but the Leyburn laybacks and having a crack on the crag, as we used to say when I was up at Ilkley in Yorkshire studying. So the whole idea of her purpose of her stuff is to she's trying to get it out of the car, so just also to see if she can do she can do her hill walking on public transport and with an electric bike. So she's taking it on the train, and she told me a horrific tale, which is on the long interview, which will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk, of just missing a train, but there was another one, a final one, the Caledonian Sleeper, going down to London, I think, as she was in the mountains up near Fort William. And she stood there with the guy saying, look, this is the last train. I missed the previous one. Can I just get on here with my bike and go a station or a couple of stations? And the train guard said, no, you can't. You're just going to have to stay here in the middle of nowhere, which is just, I mean, it's a horrifying story. And she didn't have a sleeping bag with her. She had to stay on the station all night, like shivering on a bench in the middle of nowhere. Well, that's lovely. Thank you, Scott Rail. I suppose that's the Caledonian Sleeper, the Masonic service of, that is almost impossible to get a cheap bed on that one. But anyway, so that interview with Natalie Minnis will be up on thisweek.org.uk later tonight. There is, by the way, something called vk.com, which is a Russian version of Facebook. No doubt they'll be blocking that. They've already tried to block it from my page at some point. But anyway, Natalie, I think, doing a terrific job there. And finally, we have Martin, maybe you would like to say something about this before I play it, because this is another one about the idea of Jerusalem as being the centre for a one world government. Now, various people have said this. David Livingston was talking about it in the last interview I did with him. But can you see an attempt? Do you think this is realistic of the Israelis to sort of be the centre after World War III of a kind of a new world order or a world government created after a third world war?
Well, there may be some loonies on their side who see it that way, and that they've got some kind of dispensation from the Almighty to rule everybody. But the most likely outcome of World War III is mutually assured destruction, as Scott Ritter was saying earlier. We're all going to die if we're not careful.
Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, a bit more Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, a bit bigger than Sodom and Gomorrah, because we're talking about the whole of human civilization.
The Bible talks about a new Jerusalem, but this, to me, sounds like an absolute hellish version. In a way, there seems to be an aspect of this, maybe we can wind up with you on this, Martin, is turning the Holy Land into hell. Quite obviously, what the Israelis are doing is not from God. It's massacres, it's murders, it's breaking every commandment in the book, pretty much. And although some of them, see it as a kind of twisted version of the Bible, that is the outcome, isn't it? The Holy Land is no longer holy. Look at you idiots that believe this stuff. We've turned it into hell.
Well, I'm afraid it's always been, because of the Abrahamic religions all focusing on the Holy Land, as you just called it, is that it's always been a place where battles have been fought, and it still is. And it's also, going back into prehistory, one of the first recorded battles.
But it has been pretty calm since the Crusades, surely.
No, the First World War was pretty brutal.
No, I'm talking about, well, that's when the Zionists was the Second Crusade,
There's been a lot of fighting. The Battle of Ain Jalut was fought in the West Bank between the Mamluks, who were slave soldiers in Egypt, and the Mongols. Alexander the Great sacked Sidon and Tyre and founded Alexandria in Egypt. It's because of where it is. Yeah. There's a narrow coastal strip in which Palestine exists. And of course, armies march through that coastal strip. It's been a strategic place for a long time.
There's no attempt to rub the Abrahamic faith's nose in it by evil people to just say, look what we've done to your so-called Holy Land. There's no attempt to
as a practicing Christian are trying to see.
Oh, well, about practicing.
Yeah, all right. As a Christian, I'll put it that as simply as that. You want to see these people doing evil things as not really religious. Yeah. I'm afraid evil people can be religious and evil people can be non-religious. Evil is actually just part of human nature.
These faiths, Martin, are love thy neighbour. That's not what they're doing.
No, not entirely. If you read the Old Testament, it isn't love thy neighbour. The Amaleks that Netanyahu talked about.
An eye for an eye.
Yes.
This is because many of these Zionists completely deny Christ, don't they?
Well, they don't forget that the Jews existed as a religion long before Christ came along, thousands of years before. So the Old Testament doesn't mention Christ.
So what do you think is going on then? You just think it's all focused around Jerusalem just because the Abrahamic faiths are evil?
No, I don't think that. Why is it all focused around Ukraine? It's because Perkun, the Slavic thunder god, wanted it all to be settled in Ukraine, Tony. You know who Perkunis is? He's got two faces, like Janus. Far more important than your Abrahamic gods, and you don't even know who he is.
Well, you think he is, yeah.
Well, I'm just telling you, you're going to talk about gods, let's talk about them.
I wonder who you worshipped.
How much gods do you know about?
I wonder who you worshipped. Anyway, now we know. So, finally, actually, before we hear our final piece about Jerusalem, let's have a little poem. And this week it's not from Patrizia Opulenza. She's got a little bit of competition from Darren Jenkins. We can't wait for each Friday to come to hear Tony wind up Martin. His chum. The old trot will rattle his sabre. It was much better under old Labour. But Martin, different cheek, same old bum. Have a blessed day. So that's from Darren Jenkins. Thanks, Darren. And maybe we'll have something from Patrizia a little bit more considered next week. But let's have a listen now to our final piece about the dollar bill mystery, a new world order. Is Israel trying to set up a new world order in Jerusalem?
It's alleged $1 note. How do you know that it's real? Well, because it says so here, right? $1. So you can rest assured that this is a genuine $1 note. That's exactly what's going on with Israel. It's not because somebody assumes an identity or uses a certain name that they are the real thing. This is an authentic $1 note. It doesn't only say $1, but it has all the characteristics. When we look at Israel, we need to look at the characteristics, not just be fooled by the name Israel. Anyone can say, I'm an Israelite, I'm a Jew, or whatever. We have to look at what are the hallmarks of the true Israel, according to the Torah, according to the Old Testament and the Scriptures. And then we have to look if we can see those characteristics. That's how we determine if something is real. You can't just go around and say, look, this is real because it says so. Using the Star of David and using the name Israel doesn't make you Israel. This is something we really have to understand. And then another key insight I need to share with you is that this is being presented to humanity as an everlasting conflict between one people group and another, Israeli and Palestinians. But that's not what's really going on. As we saw, the entities who are behind both Israel and Hamas, they are the ones who have caused this conflict. They are the ones who initiate this war. Essentially, this is a war between the deep state and all of humanity. And both the Israeli and Palestinian people are victim of this. We are all being fooled by a very powerful and very cunning group of people who operate behind the scenes and who pull on the strings.
So I'll put a, I'm not even sure who that is, I'm afraid, but I'll put a link up, I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Very interesting, and I think he's totally right. The idea is that the attitude of Benjamin Netanyahu and the NATO deep state could kill the entire planet if we're not careful. So hopefully someone somewhere will be able to pull a few strings and stop it. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Hedley Rees from Wales and sound engineer Dave Bozanko, particularly also to Natalie Minnis, and a full version of the interview with her up on our show page later. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips there and via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find this podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks, that's The Traitors of Arnhem and the Siege of Heaven Reader, which is an anthology of all sorts of things since from the Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination about Hidden Government and Secret Government. I think fascinating. It's kind of two different books, really. One is just about Bormann and the Bilderbergers, much more recent. The other one is far more general and wide-ranging. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this stream. And also over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioqUK.com. Do please make live recordings. Talkradio.org.uk is the live stream next Friday as well. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the app, the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. But do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Castle gate. They sang so high and they sang so low. The lady sat at her chamber late. Her heart, it melted away as snow. Some more.
thoughts whispered sweetly. You girls make no mistake, he's as cold as a snake. He'll put you in your place, barefoot and lonely. To take you, I'm only flesh and bones, no match for sticks and stones. Look under every home, he might be waiting.
Sticks and stones.